tradition is a very deep, fine feeling of the heart, of the mind, and of our way of doing things. Our behaviors, our standards. Keep them, fellows. We have them.
I'll tell you all about it.
The longer you live, and the more you think of your years of Swago, the more the word tradition of Swago is going to mean to you. And it's going to be something that you think about, something that's worthwhile, something that's fine.
Like submarines, got periscopes, like Ollie does. The rope-a-dope, I think your bad breath lady needs a bottle of scope, yo. We got to kick it.
It's like Norman Mailer needs an envelope. Like fat ass mama needs some cantaloupe. Like Walter White needs an isotope.
We need to kick it. Like the NSA, yeah. Likes to interlope. Like Billy Crystal, like the guys on soap. Like the mayor of San Diego, who likes to grope, yo. We like to kick it. On the ski slope.
Like Nancy Reagan, likes a horoscope. Like Galileo, yeah. Like a telescope. Like Mrs. Willenda, likes my thick, tight rope.
We like to kick it. On the ski slope. Like your pregnant little sister who's got to elope. Yeah. Like your boy Buster Keaton needs a skinoscope. Like Dr. Marcus Welby needs a stethoscope. We need to kick it. On the ski slope.
It's like the Cardinals. Like to meet the Pope, yeah. And like the Democrats, like to vote for hope.
Uh-huh.
Like cancers rock the Torah trope.
Whoa. We like to kick it on the ski slope.
Hey guys.
Are we live?
We are. We are now.
So real quick, Howie, why don't you do a quick intro? We've got our...
This man sitting between Alan and I is Andrew Kay, Swago White.
Our first live stream guest.
And somebody we haven't even met personally until seconds ago.
That's correct.
And
amazing.
Honor and a privilege to have you here. Thank you for coming.
It's my privilege. Really.
All right. And how we met you was you joined Facebook, or you were on Facebook, but joined the Swago page. And one day there was just this, I don't know, 70 to 100 photos of Swago from the 30s, 40s on there. And, they were amazing. And we sort of, I thanked you for putting them there, and since then sort of built up a little communication. And it's been all good since then.
One of them is your screensaver.
One of them is my screensaver.
Is that right?
Yeah, wait.
Do we get a royalty?
Yeah, you do. It's going to come up, right?
Hang on.
Somewhere on there. There you go.
That's right.
That's an amazing picture.
It is an amazing picture.
This was retained by my father. Bless his soul. He collected and organized everything.
Right.
I've got bills from 1926 also.
Wow.
The photo we're looking at, just so, because they're not seeing it on here, it's the social hall from Swago. And it's the social hall. It's the same place, the same curtains, the same windows. The piano is in the same corner, except the guys playing hoops are like, the Great Gatsby.
That's right. These pictures probably date from the early 1930s. One or two of them are actually marked.
All right.
Well, I have the original photographs in an album that my father kept.
That's amazing. I mean, that's got to be like a treasure trove, because we didn't take any pictures at camp. We have no photographic evidence of our days at Swago.
There's one other fellow from my generation who I think you can count on if you can get in touch with him, and that's Mike Saul.
Okay.
Because his father, when we connected on Facebook, I hadn't spoken to him in something like 40 years. And he said, "Do you remember me?" I said, "Yes, your father was always there with a camera." And he said, "You're right."
Mm-hmm.
And his father collected a huge trove of photographs down at the waterfront following, the group around.
Yeah.
We went up to the Diamond and all of the activities.
So what years were you at Swago?
I started in 56. And it's strange because it's exactly 30 years after my father. And
so he started in 26.
He started in 26.
Wow.
He showed up for a five-year anniversary and said, "This is the place."
Wow.
Exactly. And maybe even earlier. But I have the Swago saga intact from 1926. And
what is that exactly?
That's like a yearbook.
Okay.
But it was a big production for a long time. I seem to remember them straight through to the time that I was there at the end. I mean, when I was working there, they were still producing it. But in the early days, it was a big deal. You could actually take out advertising in it. So they were.
Whoa, who could take out advertising?
That's not really
in
smart
it.
Advertising, but the local establishments would be like, "Hey, get your bumper fixed here." Like,
it was a Swago internal.
It was
paper,
periodical,
right?
With external advertising,
and there was extra, as I remember,
General Store in Galilee.
In Galilee, get your jaw breakers here.
That's hysterical.
Wow. As opposed to where?
He had a monopoly.
I've never seen them anywhere else.
No, it's just that we didn't have a lot of choices where we would go. We had Calicoon Galilee.
Exactly.
Two general stores.
Now, I'm trying to think in Galilee if there were two general stores, because there was a huge argument. Do you guys remember Jimmy Sealand, or is he too early for you?
Jimmy
name is somewhat familiar.
Not Sealand, no. Yeah. No Jimmy named Sealand.
Okay, well, Jimmy's Hill?
Yeah.
Oh, Jimmy's Hill.
Okay, well, Jimmy's Hill is Jimmy Sealand.
It's not Jimmy Blumstein?
No.
Really? We'd always thought it was Jim Blumstein.
No, wow. And that comes from the fact that there was a barn on the hill. Mm-hmm. And the barn is where they kept the horses, you know, to use at the two camps. Mm-hmm. And the concession owner was a man named Jimmy Sealand. And it became Jimmy's Hill. Now, who's the young lady who lives on the lake?
Mary Lupo.
Yeah, Mary.
So I asked her about that, and, you know, to ask her if there was a name for it earlier. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't. They would call it Tyler Hill. Or something like that.
Thanks.
Which is very strange.
Yeah, let's call it our rival camp's name.
Exactly. Perfect. And it's very strange to me because it's only a question of conditioning. All I ever knew that location as was Jimmy's Hill, and it was for the barn.
Me too. I'd always assume it was. It didn't make sense, actually, now that I'm thinking about it. Like, why would it be named after Dave's son? Like, did he do anything on that?
Eddie Burke is confirming Jimmy Sealant was the horse guy. He ran the stables.
That's right.
And that the hill is named after him? I guess it is. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, why would it be Jimmy's, right. Dave's son? It's like in honor of his firstborn.
We never even saw. Like,
yeah, he didn't even go to the camp.
Pardon me while I get quietly.
Please, okay. take your time.
And if you can, just talk a little closer to the microphone just to even our levels out.
All right.
Very, very strict production
specifications here. You know what I'm going to do, Al? Keep talking. Don't mind me.
Okay.
I'm going to pull this.
By the way, Bert asked me if you're actually recording this. Will you have?
We will. Well, what we've done for the last almost 2 years now is we've recorded it and then posted it as a recorded podcast.
Right.
And it's
absolutely.
Only in the last two episodes that we've live streamed it.
Right.
So will you have a video copy of this one?
No, the video.
Well, I actually have saved the last couple of
you
videos.
Have,
yeah,
so
have.
We could so post it if we want.
We could post the video of this, yeah.
The audio version of it will be posted as a podcast.
Okay, so
the video is a little harder. It's a live stream, but I think we can.
But
we just started doing the live thing.
I think we will be able to post this one as a recording. So if he wants to watch us instead of hear us,
he'll
be able to.
It's great for you while we're doing this.
Thank you. Well, we were going to do it the other way.
But, you know, it'll be like
the Real Tonight Show.
No screens. It's like the legitimate skyline.
It's Swago and Swatona.
Exactly. We got to start doing it later at night. Though, so actually,
do you, when we say that we're the ski slope, does that even register for you?
No,
okay.
You know, and
probably somewhere in the 60s, 60s, Dave decided that one of the upgrades he should bring to the camp is one of those ski slopes that has like the artificial stuff so you could summer ski.
Right.
So he put it in and ran about, I don't know, a good 30 yards maybe from the senior bunks down to the lake. But nobody, I think for a year or two, maybe people got on some trays and slid down it. By the time
there were
we got there,
right? Nobody ever on skis.
No skis. By the time we got there, it was a mossy, grown-in
ledge
that it was the launch area where you'd go skiing was right by the L8 bunks, and we all would hang out there.
It was an overgrown isosceles triangle.
So that was why we called this a ski slope, because that was where the older kids would hang out and just congregate.
Well,
if you
guys were 15 years older, this would be called the batting cage. Because that's what, you know, what happened with each successive upgrade of the facilities. Now, when you were there, were the S-bunks still there or were they gone?
It's funny, they just mentioned that. Burl Gottlieb was just talking about S3 and S4.
What were the soft bunks? What were the bunks facing the basketball court?
Those were Bs. They were like Bs.
Those were the Bs. And I was
what were the S-bunks then, Andrew?
The S were... They were smallish bunks that led almost to the end of the line. They came after the L bunks. The L bunks are relatively new. Mm. And so the S bunks were there before the L bunks were there. And they were the territory of the seniors.
Okay.
So those were there for quite some time.
So the L bunks weren't constructed yet?
The L bunks came after the
S
bunks.
Really? I didn't know that.
Those are the new modern bunks.
Yeah. That's right, because they don't have the flaps.
What don't they have?
Well, none of them had the flaps, but I don't remember any having flaps by the time I got there.
How did you live without flaps?
What are flaps?
Like the flaps probably for the rain, like you put them down on the sides of the porches. You had no windows?
There were no windows. If you go back to the photograph that you had, maybe you can see it. Otherwise, yeah, I will send you some photos of the
Swago bunks were windowless. This is a revelation.
You know what?
It's going to harm your batteries going there on your Moa.
All right.
Oh, is it?
10%.
Oh, that's not good.
Right, we may have to stop and plug in and turn the table.
Right, we may have to give you guys a better view out of necessity. That's right.
That's amazing. So you have no recollection of flaps.
I started in 72. Howie, a bunch of years later, 76?
4 years
later. Yeah. So,
unbelievable. Well, when I got there and from the
76.
It's going to be 73 years for me pretty soon. When I got there,
73 is what for being on the earth
in Swago.
Really?
Mean, it's already like almost 40.
How old are you, if you don't mind my asking? Because we discussed this on a previous episode.
You gave it away already because you gave your Swago year, so you should just say.
I guess I could do the math, but
I'm going to be 67.
Oh, geez, you look fantastic for 67. I'm not just saying that. That's very good.
3-4 hours.
That's good.
That's good. You do a nice job.
Thank you. Thank you.
So let's see. So, do you still talk to some of your crew from back then?
Like, I do. And that's thanks to the reunion of a couple of years ago.
The 2012 one?
The 12 one, right? Mm-hmm. And I hadn't seen all of those guys in the thick end of whatever from, let's say, the late 60s. I guess the last year I was at, I actually did 3 years at Swatona. We can go into that later.
Cause yeah, I'd like to hear that.
That was a really strange story. But I think that the last year that I was there was 68. So you can work that out. You're talking about a long time since I had seen any of them. And I reconnected with John Leventhal. I had been talking to Chewy Lerman.
Mm-hmm.
And then the guys from my generation organized a dinner for themselves, you know, just the guys that were in a kind of core group from the same bunks. So that's John Leventhal, David Cohn, Mark Schulman.
Mm-hmm.
Who was connected to the camp for a long time as well. Let's see, who else was it? Dave Lederman, who's actually the grandson of the founder of Swago.
We met his mother,
I think. We did.
Do an annual canoe trip, and we met his mother on the lake one time.
She had the house in the middle between the two camps.
There were two houses.
That's correct.
Yeah. They had their own properties in there. So he was at the table. Steve Jacobs, who's also a kind of legend in his own time.
Mm-hmm.
So there were a lot of guys got together. It was about a dozen.
Andrew, quick, excuse us for a sec. Thanks. So we're going to have to make a quick adjustment.
My laptop is uncharged. I'm going to flip around. We're going to give you that beautiful New York City view. And we're going to be right back. Hang out.
We'll be right back with our guests.
This will take no time, honestly. Hang with us. Peace.
I'm going to be drunk by the time. Okay, so we're back.
We're back
with the reverse review.
So reverse, can you? Yeah, well, you're starting to get the skyline. So these guys are drinking a little Beaujolais. I went into the wine store and I asked for some Beaujolais, and I'm like, "Is that Beaujolais Nouveau?" They're like, "No, it's just Beaujolais." I guess it's not the most common wine, because not that this was a great wine store, but they only had 4 or 5 choices. So how did I do?
You did very well.
All right, awesome,
I've got
excellent.
No complaints at all.
Beautiful.
And I'm very fickle about wine.
Well,
I'm fickle about everything.
Well, I like when we threw out, like, you want anything to drink, and it was like Beaujolais. I'm like, all right.
You knew exactly what you wanted.
Like, very, you know. And here it is. Yeah. So, for future guests, like we say,
tell us what you want.
We'll cater to you.
Really, much obliged.
Can you squeeze in a little bit, maybe?
Me?
Yeah, just to get on the video.
Why am I not on?
You were halfway there. There we go.
There you go.
Now we're, look, come on.
There we go. Don't want to get out of
it. Right, and the alma mater was always the same, right? It was the same song?
I'm in there. I'm looking on the actual thing. I'm in there.
Who wrote the alma mater? Does anybody know?
That's a good question.
That's an excellent question, but I don't know the answer to that.
I assume it was the same. Far from Hustling City Splendor. Was it the same in
your day? Absolutely. And my guess is that that goes back to very early days. But there are other people around. Peter Janofsky is another individual whose history traces back in Swago many years. His father, Joe, was the head counselor. And really, again, it seems the camp develops these incredible personalities or attracts them or by happenstance, whatever. Another amazing individual.
Wait, who is that you're talking about?
I think it's like a very like reciprocal relationship. I think, you know, you go to camp and obviously the energy of what that is more powerful than you. So it molds you to a great degree. But you bring something to it, too. Like, you affect that equation to some degree.
I think so. And Peter's father is, you know, just... For the people who knew him, he was an institution, really. A very, very, insightful, a leader, and he was someone who gave you what I would say is earthy advice rather than simply, you know, get back in line kind of thing.
Sure.
He was an individual who had really a life view. An amazing man. And his son is a good guy, too.
All right. Well, that's good. Well, if he's a good man, I'm sure his son is okay.
So I'm just curious because, you know, I used to say that when I would talk to my grandmother, who might be 90-something, that she knew her mother who made it to 80-something. And it's like, that spans two-thirds of whatever the America, you know, the history of America. So, like, your dad started in 1926, you said?
That's right. He was born in 1916.
So how did he end up at Swago? Like, what would you know?
No is the short answer, but not satisfied with no, I'll give you some theories behind it. Actually, I was asking Peter about this because I found a link between the earliest days of Swago and something called the ethical, sorry about that.
That's all right.
And the,
it's okay.
The ethical culture society. Now you can Google that, and there is a New York chapter of that. And apparently there was some link. You'll find that the New York City school teaching system or the school teachers were intimately involved with almost everything. So Dave Blumstein came out of the New York City system. Dave Kaplan was also a teacher, the founder of
That's
the
That's true. It was all very much... I always thought it was a matter of convenience almost because they had the summers off being teachers.
I think that
that played
well,
into it. Okay.
Absolutely. That must have been a factor in their thinking. But there was a movement, really, in terms of getting kids out of the city. Also, not to put too fine a point on it, there was a tremendous amount of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. That existed. So the opportunity, even for people who had the means to have their children go outside of the city, was limited. You couldn't just go. I actually remember elements of that growing up, which is difficult to imagine now because the Jewish community is so successful that although there is still anti-Semitism, I don't mean to say that it has gone away, you're not impacted the way that you were 30 or 40 sure. years mm-hmm. ago. So I can remember driving into New England with my parents for a holiday, and there were signs on the lawn of a bed and breakfast that said, near church. And that was a euphemism for no Jews.
Really?
Amazing, right? I had a cousin who worked for Allied Chemical Company, and now I'm going back to the 50s, and he worked for them for, I'm going to say, about 15 years. One day he came out, he was Jewish, and he lost his job. I mean, these kind of things, which we don't associate with at all, because life moves on and things get better, they were big factors in the time. And one other friend, and this is why I say it's an interesting story, he became the chief pilot for American Airlines. And when he applied for a job with American Airlines, it was permissible to ask your religion. And he put free thinker. In the box.
I like his answer.
Right? Because if he had put in Jewish, he wouldn't have been hired.
Okay. Free thinker, you got the job though?
Free thinker, and he was with them for many, many years.
Free thinker is better than Jew.
I think so.
5,000 years of history, and it's like, free thinker, okay, you're in.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
So there's a different environment now. You know, the age of jet travel meant that a lot of people no longer wanted to send their children to camp. Mm-hmm. There's air conditioning. Let's just talk about that, you know. Come the summertime in 1930, that was it. You're cooking,
right?
And there's no way out.
We didn't have air. We didn't have AC at camp.
Not at camp, but
no,
home.
Not at
home.
Camp, but I'm certainly, thinking about in the city. You know,
right,
on
right.
the streets, you come out and you can fry an egg on the
right,
on
right,
the pavement.
Right. It was horrible.
So there were lots and lots of reasons to move children out of the city, and Swago was created in part, I would think, from that idea. To give the kids fresh air. And
well, we had touched on the fact on one of our earlier episodes about how the parents, I think maybe your grandparents or your parents would go to like, you know,
yeah, to bungalow colonies.
Bungalow colonies in the same general vicinity. And I guess maybe it was just a logical extension then to send your kid to a camp.
Yeah, no other community did that. By. Like the Jews of New York would go up to the Catskills. To the various bungalow colonies in the 50s, I guess it is.
Yes, the
so I just sort of like posited, you know, that maybe that's just became what you do, and then you know then camps sort of
Makes for an easy visiting day.
Parallel to that, were developed, and yeah.
I think so, but even the hotels and places in the Catskills were a reaction to the fact that Jewish people couldn't go to the other places.
Right,
that
right.
There. True. So they developed their own, which is...
So what was this normal connection between Swago and the New York Ethical Society? Because I've heard of the New York Ethical Society. I'm not quite sure what they are or what they stand for.
I have the sense, because when I look back, I asked Peter Janofsky last night. He was very familiar with the Ethical Society because his parents had taught in one of their schools. And I asked them about a name that I found on an advertisement for Swago. And there was a man's name on that, which I have never seen before, and I don't know what happened to him or even why he was there, but he's listed as a director of Swago.
What was the name? Do you remember?
I have to go back and look.
All right.
But I will let you know as I investigate more. And Peter was kind enough to give me some information and also direct me to Herb Baruff, whose father was a head counselor in the 1920s. I mean, one of the amazing things, too, which is part of the story, is that, again, from my father's records, my father kept these photographs and camp lists, and also he kept fraternity books. He belonged to a Jewish fraternity in high school called Mu Sigma, which I don't believe exists anymore.
I don't think I've heard of it.
And it's gone.
Or high school fraternity.
I haven't heard of that.
I'm not familiar with that either.
Right.
And
I gave it up after junior high.
Exactly. And the fraternity has a cross-pollination. When I looked in the lists of people who were in his high school fraternity, they turned up at Swago.
Oh, so Swago's origins is his high school Mu Sigma fraternity.
The fraternities linked these boys, and the families were linked in the same community. And then when I got there...
Was this Brooklyn?
This is all Brooklyn.
Okay.
All Brooklyn. So you're talking about Alexander Hamilton, Erasmus, you know, Tilden.
Right.
They went to all these schools. And what was amazing was that when I got to Swago in 56, which is now like 30 years after this yearbook, many of the children of the people who had been in camp with my father were now at camp with me. So there was this really, this strong generational connection.
They'd obviously enjoyed themselves when they went and said, you know, send my kids there.
Exactly.
Did your dad speak fondly of Swago? Did he
have
great times?
Oh, he was mad about the place.
Oh, he was, right.
He was absolutely crazy about the place. He loved it.
Okay.
He really did. And, you know, he was very sad when it closed. We spoke about it, and he was really distressed because it was so much of his childhood was spent there.
All of us, yeah.
Really. And, you know, the question I could ask you guys, how did you get to Swago? What was the mechanism or the path?
You know, we've talked about it on the past episode.
I'll give you my short story. I'm the last day of school, sixth grade, kid on my bus, Michael Schnapp. This friend of mine says he's going to come over, want to hang out. Sure, I'll come over to my house. I have a pool. We'll go swimming. Great. Comes over, tells me he's going to Camp Swago. Sounds good. And two of the guys who he tells me are also going to Camp Swago, and they've already been there. We're friends of mine separately, and I didn't know they even knew each other. So I was like, oh, this sounds like a good deal. So 6 days before Swago starts, you know, we called up the camp. Everything was good, and me and my brother went.
We put our
trunks on the buses at Green Acres.
Well, spontaneous.
I can remember going to Green Acres for this.
That's the only time I ever went to
Green Acres. So even back in, always Green Acres.
That was the spot.
As far as I can recall, going back to 56, but at that point in time, Green Acres was a strip mall. It was open. It was not closed. And the only...
Oh, for us store, too. For us too, it was
right?
a strip
It was
mall.
Always open?
Yeah.
Right. So actually, in a certain way, the mechanism's the same. It's
a
community mechanism.
Yeah, it was a family member. For me, it was a a family member. A cousin went there, so... This is where you're going.
Amazing.
Now.
Yeah. Really. How these things go on. So my father really loved the place. He was always very much in favor of it.
How long did he go for?
I'm not quite sure, actually. But I know that he went from being a camper to a counselor.
Okay.
There are many photographs. So
the long string. Yeah.
I would say probably a good 10 or 12 years
mm-hmm.
In that period. I spent a shorter time... because I'm restless. You know, I mean, that's the...
How many years were you there?
56. As a camper, I would say 56 to 61 or 62.
Okay.
And then I went to get a job in another camp in the kitchen, you know, working as a waiter.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that for a couple of years. And then I came back and I asked Dave Plumstead, it's a good opportunity, actually, to give him a thank you that I never gave him when he was alive.
because at that age, you don't think that anybody's really going out of their way to help you.
Sure.
But I came back there. I was unhappy at one of the places, and I came to see him. My mother was working as the senior group leader in the girls' side.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to Dave, you know, I came back, and how you doing? And I need a job, and can you give me? And he said, what can I do? He said, the guys that you were in camp with are all now like seniors. They're paying. He said, what can I do? I mean, I
like the way that negotiation turned. Nice, right? Blumstein.
Right. So, I must have really looked crestfallen, because he turned to me and he's thinking, he says, and as a throwaway line, he says to me, but he said, if you're willing, I've got a position working as a kitchen boy in Swatona. And that's real work.
Sign me up, man.
Right? So I was there in a heartbeat.
So your mother was a group leader at Swatona?
My mother was a group leader for the senior girls. I think you'll find one photograph of a trip to Corning, New York with my mother.
We were talking about that earlier. That's funny. That came up in three conversations that we always end up at Corning.
Wait a second. I got to ask this theoretically. Would you have given up being a second-year senior to be a kitchen boy at Swatona? Like, all of a sudden, it's just the middle of July. Like, listen, you can't be a second-year senior at Oswego, but you can go live at Swatona and be a kitchen boy there.
Well, if I had no choice, I would have taken kitchen boy over at Swatona.
I think I may have taken it anyway.
Let me let you in on a secret. You should take being a kitchen boy in Swatona over being president of the United States.
Wow.
That was the best deal I ever made.
Talk to us, man.
Tell us some stories.
Really, I have to say that. First of all, because it gave me a completely different perspective. I was so happy there that I came back for a second year to work in the kitchen. And the third year, Audrey, bless her, gave me a job teaching art. Now, that was a big mistake, not for me, but for Audrey. And she cut me a lot of slack. Again, at that particular age, I won't say irreverent, but that's putting a good spin on it.
Did you have the skills to be the arts and crafts guy?
Yeah, I was then in university for architecture, so I had studied drawing and design and painting and all that. So
probably a lot more than Marty had Marty. Back at our camp.
Well, you know, that
Marty was good. Marty was
yeah,
he
was.
Do you know Marty Levitt?
No, I don't.
No?
Think I
okay,
did.
He was really? An arts and crafts guy, and the actor became a head counselor at the very end. But,
right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on paper it looked good. It's just that not very much art was taught that year.
Mm-hmm.
Because suddenly you find yourself, that's the best odds you're going to get. There's like 250 women and two guys. I don't know if you know the boating counselor whose name is Jop Jungavar. You might have come across that.
Yeah, I'd remember that name too.
Definitely. Jop Jungavar.
And I think
put him on the board.
Oh, look how nice our background. You know, the Tonight Show is developing beautifully. You see the view of the Empire State Building.
I like to call it the hustling city splendor.
It's beautiful.
No,
it's
really
beautiful.
I think you should do that if you can.
What is that shadow? It looks like an evil man in our... Anyway, let's move along. Sorry.
Alan, we'll Rorschach testing it.
So Dave said to me, would I work in the kitchens? And I immediately accepted.
At Swatona.
And, it was an eye-opener for me, too, because the guys who worked at back of house, we'll call it, these were guys from Wilkes-Barre and local towns around. And, you know, they looked at me like, what? And I was the silver boy. You have to understand, everybody had a position and a title in the kitchen. It was just like, oh, we'll work in the kitchen. I was the silver guy. So
spoons,
you
knives,
the forks. Flatware.
I was the flatware man.
Yeah, silver's a little too dramatic, maybe.
Right. A prince of flatware or something.
Oh, there you
like
go.
This.
I like that.
And, of course, everything was done by hand.
Right.
All right? There were no machines. So I moved into that position. Actually, it's hard work. But I really liked it. And as I said, I came back a second year. Now, do you know, probably Teddy Klein will mean something to you. Was he not the baker, or was he gone by
then? No, Teddy Klein was not.
Don't know.
Nope.
Okay, so Teddy and Rosie Klein ran the Swatona.
Teddy and Rosie Klein,
yeah,
I love
what
it.
What a pair they were.
Teddy and Rosie.
Teddy was the chief baker for Cushman's Bakery. That was his...
Help
his,
Cushman's is...
Is it... Oh, God. No Brooklyn guys yet?
No, Bronx. Born in the
wait,
Bronx.
I'll finish the wine before
Long Island.
For
you, Entenmann's. I know Entenmann's.
You rip into us?
Yeah, before I wear out my welcome.
Where's Cushman's on Avenue P or something?
They had a huge
Ocean Avenue.
Huge plant.
Yeah.
Huge plant.
Yeah.
You know, and so he was fantastic as a baker. And Rose, they were a German couple. And let me tell you something. You never saw an organizational kitchen run like that.
Really?
It was immaculate. And what we would do is that once a week, when the dinner finished, we would be instructed to flood the kitchen with lye water. Okay? Then we had brushes like you'll see in old films of battleships. You've seen guys scrubbing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we would scrub the oak floors with the brushes.
Right.
Then we'd flood it again, squeegee and dry mop. And when we came in the morning, the floor was snow white.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the process of doing this, of course, you know, who really wants to do that kind of work? We had a kind of moment to ourselves when we would play hockey on the water. We take a Melmac cup. Now the floor is completely slick.
You? Melmac cup?
Melmac cup. Define, please. Yeah, we don't know Melmac.
Plastic?
Okay, plastic. Plastic, I know.
What were the dishes made out of? They didn't use paper plates.
No, well, they were that plastic.
I know what you're talking about. If that's Melmac, then
yeah, then we use Melmac.
The indestructible stuff.
Indestructible plastic. With like the ridge on the bottom.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly, the whole number.
Kind of yellowish, right?
Yeah.
Right, so we had them, and we would put a cup on the floor. On this wet surface, and if you cranked yourself up, ran at the cup, and then planted your feet in the ground, you would skate.
Okay.
And you'd use the brushes as a hockey stick.
Okay.
So we would play for 10 or 15 minutes before Rosie would call timeout, and then we would go back to doing the rest of the job.
Mm-hmm.
But she ran an amazing kitchen. I mean, it was
really... At least she let you let the hockey games go on. It was nice of her.
She was amazing, and also very, very strict. And I won't say that she terrorized the guys who worked in there, but there was nobody who really wanted to go eyeball to eyeball with her. Nobody. And one day, the next year when I came back, I got a promotion, and I went from silver to being the dishwasher,
with the Melvar,
doesn't sound
or whatever
as good.
It was called.
The Melvax.
But it was a boost in pay and prestige.
Prestige.
you're the dishwasher. Well, in that case.
The only guy who outranked me was the pot washer, because that guy had to be like Clark Kent to get around with these gigantic industrial pots.
Right.
So I was the dishwasher, and one day one of the other guys comes to me, and he comes into the dishwashing room, and he's standing like a soldier, and his hands are straight next to his sides, and I'm looking at him in the face, and he says, you got to help me. So what's the matter with you? I opened the wrong number 10 can of beans, and I got to get it out of the kitchen before Rosie finds out. She's going to kill me. It took us 2 days. We hid it in the refrigerator for 2 days, and then when we found the moment, we escaped with it.
The number 10 bean of cans. Okay.
The all right. Jugunda kind, the industrial size. Yeah. You know. And that was the kind of a place that she ran. I mean, it was absolutely...
Strict on inventory.
Now, just out of curiosity, do the names Augie and Angie Gonzalez mean anything to you?
No.
Who ran the canteen in your day?
My brother, actually, was running the canteen.
My brother, Morty Gonzalez?
The canteen, I assume, was the central location where the women, the boys and girls would interact, socials and things like that?
Unless you're a Sultana Kitchen Boy, yeah.
Yes.
No, they can do whatever the hell you want.
That was built in between the two.
Yeah, that on that road, right. That was. It was the same. Okay.
Right. Actually, I have a photograph of my brother behind the counter there making ice cream soda.
So your brother ran the canteen.
Well, I said he worked there. I don't know really who was the responsible party for it. You know, there must have been, obviously.
It's like a money laundering operation.
There was a
local
couple that we always knew were just a part of it for us. Augie and Angie Gonzalez, they were a local.
He was a former boxer, a Puerto Rican couple. I guess they had moved there.
Yeah, they lived in Calico.
And I think that was their. I think that was their job. Was they ran the canteen in the summer?
It must have been. I'm just saying that my memory is not that good that I remember.
Do you think they bought, like, they were responsible for buying inventory, or do you think that was Dave?
No, I think they did that.
You think they did that? I do too. That.
So they turned it into a concession.
Yeah. Basically, well, no. You think they were paid employees of Swago?
No, I think they made their money. I think they ran the canteen and made their money based on the profit that they made. They gave those canteen coupons. I'd like to see that process of, like, what did they do with the canteen coupons to then get actual dollars?
They gave them to Sheila Leibowitz.
Right? Somebody had to account for that. Had like an escrow.
There were a lot of people involved in the camps, again, the support facility. So Abe Hoberman.
You wouldn't know that name.
And his daughter is on Facebook. She's probably part of the Swago Swatona, Arlene Kyler.
I don't think so.
I haven't noticed the name, though.
Yeah. You're forgiven.
Yes, thank you.
As you'll have to forgive me when I don't know.
No, it's nice. It's just like we were talking earlier how, regardless of when you were there, the experience was transcendent. It didn't really matter. You were amongst your peers having a similar thing go on. So it's just more interesting. So now, even knowing that for you, this whole thing was going on with nobody that I've ever heard of. Like, it's not even like it bled over and that it could exist in totally isolation from what my experience was, except that it was this place. So it's very cool.
That's right.
But it's the same culture. Like,
the same thing. That's my point. The same thing.
The culture is definitely the same. Yeah. It is the same. And it revolved around similar activities. The faces and the personalities may have changed, but the environment actually didn't.
But when you were there, the owner was still the first owner, or was Dave Blumstein?
Dave Blumstein was there, and actually someone corrected me on this because I was not aware of the point at which Dave joined Swago. I thought it was much later, and in fact, I understand it went back to sometime in the mid to late 30s. So something.
Oh, Dave was involved Dave as early as
I
then.
I think it was a partnership, right?
And right, then, and then right. I think he took it. And that's when the houses got all divvied up, the 99-year leases and all that stuff. Right.
That's right. And Dave Kaplan was the original owner, and 56 was the last year that he was on campus. And again, it's interesting because of this generational thing. My father started in camp before Dave Blumstein, so his vision of Swago was centered really around the personality of Dave Kaplan. That's not to say that Dave didn't have a great personality also.
That was what he knew.
But that's what he knew. Right. And that influenced my view of the camp, even though Dave Kaplan was gone after the first year.
Mm-hmm.
So
you still felt it was a departure from the true Swago of when Kaplan was in charge.
In terms, I suppose, really, that my father's point of view rubbed off on me. I had no logical reason to think anything other than that. But in point of fact, of course, Dave put his mark on the camp and did many, many things, and he's well remembered, well thought of.
Can you think of anything specifically that Dave did once he became the man in charge that differed from what was done previously?
I can't, actually.
That was smart. That was his first smart move.
And what I would say is that he did embark on a program of, let's say, adding facilities, certainly.
Ski slopes.
Exactly.
Ski slopes, batting cages. The sailfish were like huge when
that was a new purchase.
Yeah, those were relatively new, and there was always a brawl on the waterfront
to get on those.
Oh yes.
So you could sit out in the middle of the lake with no wind and paddle yourself around.
We had one sailboat called the Catamaran, and that was sort of the best sailing ship, the granddaddy of the sailboat. It can't tip. Yeah, it was a challenge to tip the catamaran, and you couldn't do it. So, you know, that was the boat to take. But, you know,
it was Yop who taught me how to sail after being at camp for all those years and turning over.
That was a fun feeling, right? When you first learned how to do that, and you would catch a breeze the right way, and you'd pull out your sail, and you shuffle along the water,
moved,
right? And you feel like
you
felt
the power of the wind.
Of the wind. How you could like DJ it, you know?
And of course, the advantage of the sailfish is that it hydroplanes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it comes up out of the water like a water ski if you get it moving fast enough. Mm-hmm. And that really is the key to it, because, not to go into physics here, but the length of the boat limits its speed. The shorter the boat, the slower it goes. So the sailfish defies that by acting like a water ski if you get it moving. And if there's no wind, you're going to just, as you say, you're going to sit there.
Right.
But if you get it going fast enough, it really hustles.
Does the Apache relay mean anything to you?
I was just going
to
ask that same. Well, I guess because it's not that crazy.
I had my only moment of sports.
So it existed. So it was part of Color War when you were, okay.
Yeah, it gave me my one moment of shining glory.
What was that? What did you do?
I nearly burned the camp down.
Oh, you were the fire burner at the end.
One of those arsonists.
There was a place up at the end of one of the diamonds where we used to boil a can of water.
Right, no, it still existed. Right. Yeah.
Okay, so
up on the diamonds too. Didn't move.
Didn't go.
No. I picture Evan Pryser doing that.
Yeah.
So I was responsible for that. You certainly wouldn't want to give me a basketball or a baseball to handle.
Right. So that was you boiled the water.
So I boiled the water, and I was out in a minute and a half. Because I spent...
You knew what you were doing.
Yeah, I spent like about 2 hours gathering the proper sized twigs. So I threw one match on it and went, whoop, right? And for whatever reason, because I suppose what happened to the other guy, and I don't even remember who I was against, he panicked, you know, when everything just falls apart and he couldn't get
it. I know that feeling. I'm doing fine.
He was like, and it took him an hour to get out of there. The race was over by the time he got the thing lit. And so, of course, you know, being the great fire starter that I am.
You got sent up to the flagpole?
I got sent up to the flagpole that day.
That was the great honor, right? Is like, you know, it's always sent up to the flagpole. That was a nice little thing, right?
It's amazing how little, how many things were identical. You know,
no, of course.
Certainly in the '50s. I mean, I can wonder if in the '20s there were even.
I think the color war plaques. 30s. Like that was the beautiful.
Did they
thing
go back
the
to the '20s? Those plaques.
1921, Irving Engelman. Like color war, green versus white was there.
And that was always
there
was always it was always campers. Is that like right? That never changed somewhere. A lot of other camps had counselors. As like led the color war.
No,
they and we loved the fact that, you know, I thought that was a great thing about Oswego that the campers did.
They used the campers to lead it. And the other thing which they, I think Dave Blumstein changed this because my father had conniptions. In the early days of the camp, when you were a white, that was you done.
You stood. The girls were that.
Swetona did that.
The boys camp did switch. The boys camp switched.
And my father was on the white team all of his career in Oswego. And the first year I was in Oswego, I was on the green team. And he said, "What is?
How can that happen? You know,
it's like right, it's Shonda. Like,
right.
So, how dare you be a green?
You're a crip.
How dare you do that?
It is. It's very much
in the backyard for a week. But it was, you know, slightly different in that respect.
Our only thing with that was that your brother had to be on, supposedly. Me and my brother, for some reason, got separated actually two times.
You did.
But for the most part, you had to really be on the same team as your brother. But other than that, you could switch year to year. And I always thought it was like an amazing logistical exercise for Swetona to have to figure out every year
how to make sure. They had to balance people who were fixed in at certain colors.
Like how do you get, you know, you're hoping the new campers that come in are the equal to the ones that are leaving and then they'll replace it on the teams. There had to be times where it was just like, how do we make this work?
That could be one of the reasons why Dave changed it.
Right.
It could have been a logistical problem. I don't know actually how many campers there were in those early days. I should go back and just simply count.
But it's nice because Swetona, more so than us, because we don't have it, like when they identify themselves with camp, they're like green or white.
Right.
You know, they're very identified with whatever color they are. And it's nice because if you become a leader for that team, you know, it just solidifies it. I mean, I guess for me, like I was leader on white, so you know, that'll be the first color I go to. But it wasn't like I was on white every year. You know, I was on green like just as many times.
No,
as I
also
white.
Alternated up and back.
I was mostly white, but definitely wasn't only on white. So we would be remiss, given that Audrey died, you know, in the last couple of days, not to talk a little bit about her, because we said earlier I never said a word to Audrey in my entire Swago career. I had no reason to. It was just. We were over there. She was there. You saw her walking around. Right. But it sounds like you knew her. You knew her
knew her very well, and my parents were friendly with Audrey and her husband Joe, and of course I knew Bert and Nancy, who were there in camp when I was, as well as Nancy. I think was on the waterfront the year that I was teaching the art. Purportedly teaching the art. I think
supposedly.
Not a lot of lanyard coming out of Swetona.
That was
year.
In the art room, right?
No, there was not. No, actually, the main memory that I have was where we had the visiting weekend, right? And the parents came in, and I was frantic about what I was going to do.
No projects.
You know, there was like nothing in the art house. Just bare with a few things.
It's like, what's been going on
it's
here?
The minimalist thing.
Minimalist, right. Mies van der Rohe.
Speaking of light.
That's what we're studying.
Exactly. So what I did when the parents came in is I turned the tables on them and I had them draw portraits of their children, which was the way that I escaped because everybody was busy and they didn't really notice.
There's nothing else, right.
Wrapped up in themselves.
And did Audrey have, so Rita Swedlow was her right hand person.
That's right.
In our day, was that true? Was she there for a long time?
There for a long time. And I think I can't say exactly, but I'm going to give my mother credit for that because my mother was teaching in the same school with Rita. And I think that is where the connection began.
Okay.
But you can check with her children.
Alex, we know. Alex, he was around during our years.
He's
great guy.
Right.
Yeah.
So
he was a counselor for us.
Yeah.
Alex would probably be able to say if I'm making this up or not, but I believe that they were teaching together. And so that was the intro to being at Swetona. Mm-hmm. It might have even gone back. I'm trying to think if it went back to the point where Audrey herself was the head counselor. That's a possibility too.
Again, I think it is because I think it was Kaplan that owned everything, and then Dave bought in, and then somehow
brought in.
Well,
Audrey.
Audrey came in. I don't think Audrey was an owner from the get go.
What was the deal? Were Dave and her 50-50? Was what I always understood
that's
it,
what
to
I remember it to be. Yeah.
I
yeah.
think perhaps they were, but I'm going to go back earlier because Dave Kaplan started it, and then there's another personality that hasn't been mentioned.
Who's
yet.
Who's that?
Eddie Justin.
I don't even know that name.
Yeah. Right? Okay. So Eddie Justin was the partner in Swatona. And then I can't tell you.
Partner of who? Who was he partner with?
Dave Kaplan.
So, okay. So Dave Kaplan did the same thing that Dave Blumstein did, owned all of Swago and was half owner or whatever of Swatona,
right,
had a partner.
He brought in partners.
That was smart.
To go with him. Probably as he got
woman,
on in
but...
years. I mean, that's another factor. It's
what was that?
As Dave Kaplan got on in years, he wanted to have some kind of continuity.
How old was Dave Kaplan? Like, was he, he was older than Dave Blumstein, I guess.
Oh,
by
yes.
What, 10, 15 years?
Well, I'm going to say he must have been much older because he was running the camp when my father was a camper.
Okay.
Mm. Right? So my father's born at 16.
Right.
So I'm going to say that probably Dave Kaplan would have been born... probably in the late 1880s, something like that.
Wow.
All right,
that's crazy.
1890s.
That's crazy.
Something like that. He would have been a contemporary of my grandparents.
It's amazing.
So it is really. It's amazing. So he brought in at some point, I'm not exactly sure, he brought in Eddie Justin, who ran the camp. And then I'm not exactly sure because I think it happened in the years that I might have been away. Eddie Justin went out, and then ultimately he brought Audrey in.
Mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, I think Audrey bought the whole thing. I'm not sure.
Okay. I think, my memory of when I was a camper was that it was a 50-50 partnership, Swatona, with Audrey and Dave.
Probably so.
But what did I know? You know, I was, you know.
Well, we can always make it up. You know,
you can always make it up, right?
I
didn't see the documents.
Just enjoying themselves listening. No one's really going to go to the Swago Encyclopedia. I'm going to take a quick break. I don't know if you want to keep going.
Yeah, we can keep going.
All right. I'll be back.
All right.
So what was your interpersonal relationship with Audrey like? Well, to me, she always seemed, and again, it's just from a distance, like she was very serious. Like I didn't see her as a very loose, like sort of, comical woman. She always seemed very serious to me.
Well,
but again,
it's
from a distance.
She was very focused, you know, and she took the responsibility of running the camp very seriously. Actually, when you think about it, we tend to ignore the procedure, the processes that go on for the camp, whether it was Dave Blumstein or it was Audrey. You know, we come there, we want to have a good time, and obviously everybody has an opinion about what should be changed and what should have been done this way. You know, why do we have cupcakes on this day? Why don't we
swim
have
instruction
that?
First period? Come
right,
on.
I don't want to go out of the bunk when it rains. That sort of thing. So everybody has an opinion, but Dave and Audrey had to actually execute. So that's really the rub. They're stuck with the final responsibility as well as the authority. They have the responsibility. So Audrey was, again, one of these forces of nature in terms of her personality. She was a very strong personality. And of course, I saw her in those moments when she was actually more relaxed. I won't say that she was easygoing personality that way, but in moments when she was relaxed, when she wasn't dealing with camp issues or things like that.
She'd be lighthearted.
She'd be much more lighthearted. And actually, I think there's a photograph that I posted of Audrey standing on the porch of her house with my parents. And you could just look at the smile on her face and understand that, you know, she's coming, if you will, out of character to be just a friend.
Right.
And shoot the breeze.
Right.
And do that. I've got another photograph also, which I have to find the copy of it to send to Bert, of his father with Audrey and my parents also on the porch.
It's funny, I think like at the end, because when Al and I were campers, you know, like when we were seniors, it was, you know, 79, 80. By that time, Dave was a little older. And in a way, I think we always admired how well-run Swatona was compared to Swago. Like for us, we enjoyed
Swago's a bit of a free-for-all.
Right. For us at 15, 16, like you want a camp that's not going to be like you have to do this very regimented. It was, you know, basically you had to do some stuff, but you had your time to yourself too. But Swatona always seemed like, I remember watching Birthday Ball. Was that what it was called? It was sort of like Color War, but they you'd be on the team of whenever you were born, whether it be winter, spring, summer, fall. And it was so well conducted. I mean, it was just, they were on their tennis courts and Audrey was sort of orchestrating everything. I was just admiring how well they did that. And even things like when they would sing their alma mater and they'd break into the harmony at the end. Like, I was like, how do they even know, like, who should go up and who should go down? And they just figured that shit out.
I think that's a tribute to Audrey, really.
Yeah.
Just
a very effective woman.
Very effective, very organized. And, you know, I have to say on a personal level, especially considering the last year that she cut me a lot of slack. So when you say, was she...
with the art?
With the art. I mean, we're talking big time now.
Okay.
If I had...
She's like, you told the parents to draw pictures of themselves?
Do you know the kiln has not been turned on once this year?
Exactly.
Why is our energy bill so low?
Where's the plug? I was supposed to build a tea house for one of the...
I don't really know what that
tea
is.
For a tea house on the August Moon. It was one of the productions in the social hall.
A play. Okay.
And I, of course, being an architectural school, I rather overreached. So when the tea house made it...
You built the grand tea mansion.
The grand tea house. And when it finally got to the...
They're like, it's too big for the social hall.
Well, it wasn't too big. It just wouldn't stand on its own.
Well...
So it was a small problem. And there was a tea house supported by a lot of ropes. Literally, a lot of ropes. But I did do the repair because... And that was another thing that got me in trouble. After the play was over, I said, no, we have to finish this now. Why? Because I moved it down to the lake and set it up on rocks so you could step over the shore onto this tea house. And I had my own little...
What is a tea house?
What are you going to do?
It was nothing more than a platform, you know, 2x4s and decking. And then what I had done is, in order to get the effect, I had put a 4x4 post in the back and cantilevered the whole roof system.
Cantilevered?
Jeez.
Right? That's why I say it was a bit of an overreach.
Yeah, I don't even understand.
I'm going to have to see a picture of that.
I'm going to have to look up.
Do you have a photo of the tea house?
I don't, actually. But just imagine that everything is supported like that.
By that? All right.
Okay, that was the idea. Except this had a tendency to...
He's holding scotch tape for our podcast listeners, by the way.
So there were, you know, cabling and whatever to keep the thing up. And Audrey was not very happy with me for that. And also for...
So what did that mean? Like, did she pull you aside and like sort of say, hey, listen, the tea house isn't working out?
You gotta burn the tea house.
That's a good spin on it. No, really, I can't say that she caned me in proportion to the things that I didn't do or did wrong. No. And
did you leave with guilt like that summer? Were you like, I let her down? Or
no, that's the whole point.
Oh, okay.
Under 20, 19, 20 years of age, I had no sense of guilt or shame at all.
Great.
Thought, you know, hey, I'm here and there's a couple of paintings and what are you worried about?
And just logistically, like, how did that work out? Like, you've got the senior girls and some, I guess, young counselors there at Septona too. Did that work out in your favor?
Absolutely. Yeah. Actually, one of the counselors from that year, I've maintained, she's married, of course, with her own children. Jenny Lee Spaulding became a lifelong friend of mine from that year. And I stayed with her last summer. Barbara came over and hadn't met her. So Barbara came over to...
That was easy? That was comfortable? Everyone was cool?
Yeah, everything was cool. So there were friendships formed. Yop also. I hadn't seen Yop in God knows how many
years. J-O-P-P?
J-A-A-P.
Like Jap, very appropriate for Swatana.
And
you son of a bitch.
And, you know, there are some, as you know, obviously, from your own generation, there are lifelong friendships that have formed in these places. And the girls, it was, like I said, it was the best odds that I ever had in my life. I'd go back there and wash dishes tomorrow, except that Barbara would shoot me.
Where did you live? Did you mention that? Where were you living at
that
time?
Well, when I was a kitchen boy, I lived at the back of the kitchen up on a hill, which when it rained, there were no steps.
Back of the kitchen. I'm trying to see the girls. Where was
the
girls'
mess hall? Sort of right on their main campus, right?
Right.
Sort of like the front of it was on...
I got it. Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So there was a service road.
Right on the back side there.
And if you're going down that road and the kitchen is to your right, then there was a hill with a couple of bungalows on top of it.
Okay.
All right.
The swamp, we used to call it. And that was where I lived then. And when I became the arts counselor, I moved to the front end, we'll call it, of the campus. As you approach Swatana, there were a couple of buildings on the right.
I remember where the night watchman would be around there.
That's right.
As you come down the canteen, the road to Swatona.
Right.
There were a couple of bunks right there.
Right.
On the other side of the hill where the sports stuff was.
Right. So the boating counselor, the arts counselor, and the handyman lived there. There were three of us in there. And we had a pretty good time.
All right, good. Right. What'd you do with your time, like, when you weren't in the mess hall and you were a kitchen boy? Like, how'd you spend the rest of the time? And it was on Septona's campus, I would imagine.
That's right. I was pretty free to go anywhere. I think there was a point at which Audrey cautioned me about interacting with any of the campers. you know, more than seven.
The campers, right? Councils, you know,
councils
go to town.
Do as you wish.
You know, do as you wish.
But leave those rangers alone.
Exactly. Well, there was a little age gap.
Well, with the seniors, there wasn't that.
No, that's true.
There wasn't really
age gap at all.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, as far as I was concerned, this was like open season.
Everything's good.
Everything was
so
all
any
good.
Any great romances at Spotona? Was it this one woman who you'd mentioned? Was that your? If you had a.
There were several, which was the start
tell.
Of a lifelong pattern. I'm sorry I met you so late. I could have put your kids through college. My lawyer told
me. I don't do divorce, unfortunately.
Well, you would have gone into it. Believe me, it was a very lucrative field. Finally, my lawyer said to me, you should just.
Well, how many divorces do you have under your
several.
Belt?
Several.
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 Wow.
We don't, Barbara. She's watching this from the hotel. But
you got it right now.
Is that
right?
Are you on, Barbara? If you're on, Barbara, I want to see you hit
and
the chat.
And if any of the ex-wives from Spotona are on,
yes,
you know, you can chime in as well.
No, I finally settled and settled with the right one.
You found, it took you a few tries, but you
it
found
took,
the right,
it
right lady.
It took me, you know, a dozen.
A dozen?
Yeah. Well, my lawyer said to me, why don't you just find somebody you hate and buy them a house?
It's a faster. You're going to get to the end point.
Save yourself years of angst.
You know what? He's right.
How long have you been married now?
We're together 10 years.
Oh, good for you.
All right. I can see some momentum.
Yeah, there's some momentum there. No, really, we have a great relationship. Not just good.
That's good.
Relationship. It just took me a little while.
Yeah, it takes a little while.
Sometimes. But at Swatona that year, the odds were good. The odds were really nice.
It's a unique experience. Not a lot of people. No, that wasn't your wife. You thought no. She was beeping in there, huh?
I think it was my wife. It is my wife. It's funny.
It's the other guy's wife.
Yeah. Hang on one
second. The view out the window in the back is now absolutely amazing.
Right? We got the Jack Parr thing going.
Oh, that's true. Out the Empire State Building here.
Right. You guys will only pay scale now, I suppose.
Well, we'll have to pay ourselves.
You'll have to, yeah, exactly. It's free until...
This is all self-employed. It is amazing. Like, we joke about the fact that, like, we're able to do something like this. And I have to give Alan some props today because he actually went out and bought a camera that we're not using because we didn't have time quite to figure it out. But that'll
scale things up even better. We bought a higher quality camera.
Yeah, so we're really taking it to the next level.
We enjoy this so much. It's just...
I love it.
First off, just, you know, Howie and I have been close since camp and, like... We were getting together anyway. We were seeing each other frequently, and then this idea came up, and it's even a greater way to spend time because it's sort of coalesced. It's around Swago, mm-hmm. And it's like it's just an amazing thing. We've been enjoying this so much. This is like our 27th episode.
I know we run it's a fine line. Like we don't want to come off like we're sort of annoying everybody else and like listen and watch our show. But
yeah, come on, everyone. Wants
we
to.
Love. Like sharing camp, like this is it. Because camp, when it comes down to it, it's the people. I mean, more as much as the location, it's the people. So if you can get some interactivity of people sharing memories and discussing,
and
it comes back to life.
For the record,
yes,
this podcast, your podcast, the Andrew K podcast, will be the podcast that brings our listenership over 5,000 listens.
It's true.
Really?
Yeah, 5,000. Yeah, it's amazing.
Total listens.
Amazing.
That is pretty good,
we
right?
We started this out. We were sitting here with a microphone.
Like if two people listen,
like,
well, it'll be cool.
We were saying, okay, what would make you happy? We're like, all right, 25 people. If 25 people listen to it, it'll be all right. And then like 180 listened to it the first time. And now it's almost 2 years later. We've actually had 5,000 separate listens.
I think that's terrific.
Pretty cool.
4,800 are me and Alan, but.
And every one of them, with I'm sure very few exceptions, is a Swago and Swatona person.
And that doesn't include
wants
downloads.
To stay connected, you know.
That's right.
Yeah,
there's a lifeline there that goes through several generations.
Well, your experience very unique. You know, there's not many people we'd meet who went to Swago, worked in Swatona.
Father went to Swago.
Father went.
No,
the ownership of Swago, Swatona. You're really ingrained in that first generation of Swago Swatona.
Well, they say the
people.
Older you get, the more you become like your parents. Mm. And in this respect, I, for whatever reason, I just seem to absorb all of this enthusiasm for Swago.
So your love for it really came on over time. It wasn't so much when you were there that you loved it as much?
No, I actually enjoyed it.
You did? Okay.
I did enjoy it when I was there. I can't say that, you know, I went there and I thought, what am I doing here after 3 weeks
right.
or something like
right.
that? No. The first year, I do remember I was very excited on visiting day when my parents came up and my
sure.
grandparents came up.
Oh.
And it's amazing.
We discussed that too.
Because there are photographs which I posted which show my grandparents on campus with my father and my uncle going back to the 1920s and 30s. And you could see, I think in several of them behind them, the Adirondacks, right? They still use that term?
Yeah. We had the wives of the group leaders would live there.
Right. I'm talking about the row of trees
where the chairs were. The Adirondacks were right at the top of where the flagpole was.
Correct.
No? Right,
yeah. Oh, okay,
correct. There was a row of trees there.
Right, I got you.
And if you look at these photographs, you'll
see that volleyball court was, that perfect lame volleyball.
Where the road is.
There was a volleyball court up at that end, too. Those trees were planted by Dave Kaplan. So in those photographs, they're like really small. Mm-hmm. And then as you go on in time, by the time I got to camp,
it's interesting you say that. If you think about the road, it is pretty evenly spaced, the trees.
Yeah, no.
It doesn't look like they just naturally happened that way.
They didn't. Dave Kaplan.
When you were there, was the golf course used? Do you remember before you got to the sign that said you got into Swago?
I remember the golf course, and I think there were like two operative holes and greens.
That was another one of those things that was like, oh, we have a golf course. It wasn't really the under-16 golf tournament. It wasn't really...
How about the lodge? Was the lodge still operating when you
were not quite sure what the
lodge
was.
I think, was the place where some of the
I'm thinking
adult
that's what the Adirondacks
stayed.
Was, right?
But the Adirondacks was just the trees and the
chairs.
Right,
but I'm thinking what I thought was
the lodge.
The lodge was where
the shooting range was.
Okay, right.
So back past
all the way back.
Behind the golf course.
The shooting range, I remember.
Behind the golf course back,
Well, the lodge was a place that parents stayed when they came up.
I had heard that there was a point where people would stay there and pay.
I didn't know that option was available. That your parents could just come up.
Well, it wasn't
hang out,
when we
hang
were
at
there.
The lodge. But actually, they could have had that. Why not monetize that? If we're still around now, I'd take a weekend at the lodge.
I think it was also a question of the idea that you would send your kids away and coming up for a day and then leaving was like you're going to tear these kids away.
You can make an argument that I said this when my son was at camp, that they really shouldn't have his any day.
It's just disruptive.
Yeah,
the kids are fine.
Yeah, it's true.
Not for the kid, but agreed. But I feel like it was more.
I see what you're saying, but I think overall, like it is, it's, you know what, it sets the midpoint of the summer to some degree. For the kids that are having trouble dealing with it, you can always go and say, well, it's all downhill now. You've been here half the time. You're going to be home in 3 or 4 weeks.
I remember 2 weekends.
Really?
I remember two.
No, I think we only had one. I mean, there would be that other time where like.
Two day weekends?
Yes.
Was one boys, one girls? Or?
No, I remember my parents coming up twice.
So this is an interesting question. Not to flatter my own question, but did you have, were you, a, so when we went, it was a solid 8 weeks.
It was 8 weeks.
Now it's like 7 weeks, 6 and change for kids, 7 weeks.
It was like exactly 8 weeks for us.
Exactly.
I mean, we would leave on a Wednesday or Saturday.
It was 8 for you,
Andrew,
same thing?
It was a solid 8 weeks.
Okay, ours was a full 8 weeks.
56 days.
Full, right.
Exactly. You'd go home the same day of the week you went up. Unless I'm crazy, but I kind of remember it being exactly that.
I knew it was exactly 8 weeks.
Okay.
So it wasn't longer than that earlier. That wasn't the first shorten. Okay.
No, I worked at one place that did run for 9 weeks, but that.
So
that
there
was
were.
Unusual.
Okay. Yeah, that's.
That was an unusual setup. But the Swago and Swatona, I'm almost 90% sure, or higher than 90, that it was exactly 8 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was
That's what it was for us. And do you remember, just out of curiosity, what it cost when you went to Camp Swago?
About
be
six,
200 bucks, 400 bucks?
I
what
wish.
Could it have been?
I think
oh, really?
It was more like six.
It was. Okay. Because by 72, I remember it was around like $1,100 or something like that.
76, 77, it was $1,100.
Okay. That sounds
started
right.
At six, and the last year I was there, it was up about 750. Something in that.
It's a good deal.
Even at 10K today, it's still not that bad.
Yeah, I guess. It seems astronomically higher though now, doesn't it? But it's not, I guess, relatively.
Well, it's funny because Aviva posted something the other day about visiting a pizza place on Avenue J in Brooklyn that I remember from high school. And I posted back that it brought back really incredible memories from a very long time ago. And I looked the place up to see how long it had been there, and they said that it had reached, it was the first pizza restaurant in New York City to charge $5 for a slice.
Five for a pie?
No,
for a slice.
For a slice.
Oh, now you mean?
Now.
$5 for, I don't know.
For a slice.
You got your place downstairs, $3.75, 2 slices and a Coke.
Right, I'm ready.
Yeah, well, even today, I don't know for $5 for a slice.
Okay, $5. So when I wrote a response to Aviva, I said, you know, I remember the place really well, and I was shattered when the price went from 15 to 20 cents a slice.
Even so, I remember, I'm about to be 50, and I remember in my time, you could go get two slices. It was like 35, 40 cents a slice. You could be in and out for $1.75.
Something like that. I would get two slices and a Coke.
You'd be done.
I can remember, actually, well, you guys not being from Brooklyn, you're not Nathan's people.
No, I'm a Nathan's guy.
I like because we went to Yonkers.
I was Long Island.
Our family's from the Bronx, and we went to Yonkers to the Yonkers Nathan's. Yeah.
Well, if you go back to my high school years, approximately, it was possible. We used to do food bets, and the bet would be: could you eat $5 worth of food at Nathan's?
It's probably a lot of food back then.
Nobody could do it.
Hot dog was 15 cents. So $5 is a stretch.
Ooh, that's like Yokoshaki, whatever that guy is. Right. The hot dog contest.
Maybe that's what brought about the eating contest.
That would be, that would be ugly.
The fries, the jumbo fries were a quarter.
The fries were the best. The fries were the best.
Those thick crinkled fries that they got crispy.
They were almost
on the
like
outside.
Little slices of baked potato.
They were. Right? They were nice. Right.
So
did you go? Which high school did you go to?
I went to Erasmus on Flatbush Avenue.
Okay.
And actually, again, I don't know if you know, but Steve Jacobs was there, and we didn't know that the both of us were in the same school at the same time.
Steve Jacobs is Cobbs.
That's right. That's Cobbs.
So Cobbs is how far apart are you? Cobbs is your age.
Contemporary.
It's my age. Yeah, he's within 6 months or a year of my
okay.
Age.
So Steve Jacobs is one of your contemporaries. Cobbs is one of those names that if you went to Swago, you heard the name Cobbs at some point.
Well, I remember when we were seniors, he came up to camp to visit. And we were just sort of like, who's this guy?
Who's this Cobbs fellow?
You know? And it's funny, at the time, you're 15 so to 16, you're sort of like, who's this guy? Like, what's he doing here? You know? But like then now you're like, all right, I get it. You know, because we never had the opportunity to go back when we were like 35, you know?
What was really funny is we used to joke that Steve looked exactly like his father at that age when he was 15. He was moving like his father already. I don't mean slowly now, not at all. But he had the same mannerisms as his father. So he was an institution in and of himself and quite a character.
Yeah, a lot of people have said we got to get him on. And also John Leventhal, who I think is also contemporary, right?
Yes, John is really
we definitely would like them
a great
to come
guy.
On.
You don't want to miss out. If you can lure him on here.
Okay.
We will. We'll get them all. We figure we got time.
He's a judge, though. He may be a little inhibited.
You never know, though.
You never know. I heard he's a good guy.
He's a good guy, and
and a fair judge.
And a fair judge, which is more important. Doesn't like plums, though.
Oh, so you know that
I know the plum story, yeah. And I heard you can't even reference it to him. Like, he'll get upset.
So. Don't do that.
If you go into his courtroom, don't bring a plum to get him happy.
No.
Your Honor, would you like a prune?
That's the shortest line between where you're standing and Rikers Island.
All right. That's fair enough.
And what's amazing to me, of course, is because I didn't have a constant connection with the guys for many, many years, my image of all of them, you know, when you talk Steve Jacobs or John Leventhal, I see them in my mind's eye as children.
Sure.
They're still children. So to see this guy standing in front of me now who's...
Yep, an adult.
Right, adult, full... but it probably takes about 5 minutes for you to make that, like, conversion over to, like, okay, it is this guy. Like, now I'm used to him.
Well, I say that I'm used to him. I think what is amazing is that he has the same disposition that he had.
Well, everybody does. Doesn't every? Well, I mean, you get older, but your soul stays the same, you know, for the most part.
I hope so. I would like to think so. I get more cranky and intolerant.
But it's still you deep down. You know what I mean? Hopefully. Like, you know, the people that know you the best still know you. It's funny. We had a guy, David Becker, and he was in our group, and he stopped as an inter. And we haven't seen him since. I mean, it was like literally, what was it, 1978?
Yeah.
Haven't seen him since. And then he randomly shows up because I think his sister was on Facebook. So he got word of the fact that we were, you know, having one of those musical get-togethers that we have. And he showed up to it and was like, boom. At first it was like, oh, you're David Becker? Because it didn't really look like him.
No.
But then it was him. Then it's like, you know, five minutes later, it's like, okay, got it. You assimilate that. You know?
I think for the most part, it's really an extension of the good guys, as you say. The people who are good-natured at that age and stayed that way. Because also one of the things that astonished me, which I shouldn't really have been astonished with, is the diversity of where life has taken all of these people.
Right.
You know, so you have one guy who's become a judge and another guy who's become a clinical psychologist. Davy Cohn, who was just a very easygoing guy, a good athlete as well when I was in Swago, had a brilliant academic career. He graduated, and I think he got 800 on his math SATs, something like that. And I think he's a doctor now. So, you know, people have gone into medicine.
They've gone into law.
One of the guys ended up in California. He's a math teacher at the University of Southern California.
Huh? And my son just got in there.
He's taking a math class. You know who to sign up for.
Yeah, film school.
Right?
Yeah,
I got it right.
Yeah.
Great. Take that note. I think his name is Kenny Levitt, and he apparently did some work that helped to solve Fermat's last theorem. Don't ask me to explain.
Swago.
But, you know, some amazing mathematical work.
Yeah.
So all these people have gone into different places, done different things with their lives. David Lederman, of course, was a tremendous chef and started a great business.
David's Cookies, right?
David's Cookies. So, you know,
David's Cookies was a Swago guy?
David Lederman.
David
Lederman? You mean Mickey Mantle's David Lederman?
Is the one David's that Cookies, yeah.
I did not know
You didn't
that.
Know that?
I did not.
And they put cookies.
Yeah, they were great. Good. They were the first, like, Mrs. Fieldy kind of. Yeah.
Like, it's not Chips Ahoy's. It's some sort of, like, you know, micro-brewed chocolate chip cookie.
But didn't you had to buy it, like, at a store, at one of his stores, right? It wasn't a packaged product.
Exactly.
So, Davey, as far as I understand, in his career as a chef, it took him to Europe to study and practice. So you don't really know in life where.
But it's such a great opportunity.
Crew, we have the same diversity of guys. One of the kids from our years won a Grammy for writing a Norah Jones award-winning album. Another kid wrote a screenplay. Another guy's a famous chef.
One of our guys is like
Sideman.
Yeah, Russell.
Russ Gores.
Another guy is a well-known.
Eric Friedman is running Skadden Arps.
Now, is
Eric
Russell
Friedman runs.
To the other
he's the managing partner of Skadden Arps.
Really? I did not know that. What's that?
Is Russell connected to the other Gowertz family, the Billy and Mark?
I don't think he is.
I don't think he is.
I'm not sure about that, but my gut tells me he's not.
And yeah, we talked to Russell last week, so I don't.
No.
No.
But
I don't
think
so.
This is just what I mean. You don't know where life is going to take you.
But it's, you know what? But it gives you such a great opportunity because, like, you know, people are, you know, the campers that are going there, they're, you know, for the most part, they're fairly bright guys, if you know, and you get along with them, you get to share with them 2 months of time exclusively without parents into getting involved in this, and maybe
that's
the counselor to some degree, but that's not as bad. And this is, you know, great osmosis that goes on where you get to sort of, you know, trade intellectual thoughts or be funny, and it makes you wiser as a youth, much more so than if you didn't have that opportunity.
I think so. I think there's a lot of interaction, interfacing between the boys, because you have to work at your own problems too.
Right. The getting along process.
Really, and you don't want to go into Steve Jacobs' face. I'll tell you that right now. Maybe you could do that. You're more in shape than I am. But you know, you have to adjust to the realities of your little world there,
right?
Whatever they are, and that's. It's a shame you didn't have flaps. I can't believe there's no flaps. You know,
I still don't know what they are, but all right.
Well, imagine that.
I know what they are because I've seen sort of like in. Army movies where they pull the flaps down like to
like I have it on my tent when we go on the canoe trip. They had it for the bunks.
Well, I guess they had it for the windows and the porch area. Maybe you could were they the porch things that would slide down? Or was it just flaps on the windows?
There were no windows at all, either on the porch. There were flaps on.
So what do you need flaps for if there are no windows?
There were no windows.
So that if it was raining, I guess you could block the rain.
Exactly.
From what? There's no window.
Well, let me
the
tell
rain
you,
comes
let
straight
me tell
through.
You, once in a while, you really are very straight happy that those things are there.
Well, what's it coming straight through?
The empty hole. There was a cutout. There just was no window.
Okay. There's a hole for
the
window?
There's no glass.
I thought it was just log.
No, it was a prison.
That's what I'm thinking. Like,
they were buried underground.
All right. No, then flap away. Flap away.
So the wall came only up to chest high.
Gotcha.
Right? And then there's a gap to the
ceiling. I got it. And that was where you had the...
And the flaps rolled down from that.
It was more like an open kind of a thing.
Right.
How are you going to get a guy out in his bed while he's still sleeping if you don't have flaps?
I don't know. It's a damn good question.
An alarm clock.
These are serious issues because we would take a guy and fold up the legs, right? And if he was a deep sleeper, you could get him out of the bunk and set him up on the raft.
You know, we had two things. We had like put his hand in warm water, and supposedly he's going to pee.
Right. Never saw it work.
And then the Bengay on the genital area
painful.
That wasn't good.
That wasn't
sadistic. But I think people would back out of that and then eventually go for the toothpaste as opposed to the Bengay. You know, sort of lighten it up a little bit.
Well, I can remember, you know,
still very.
Still,
I wasn't putting that on anybody's.
That wasn't touch. First of all, I didn't want to touch anyone's balls to start off with. But
I mean, that's key, right?
Yeah. Sorry, we digress.
No, this is important things. I'm reaching back into tricks I haven't thought of now in 50 years.
Short sheet the bed?
Short sheet.
I wasn't quite sure what that was either.
No, my brother came up
folding
with
a sheet in half, so when you stick your leg in, you can only get halfway down.
That's right. You would
don't you figure that out pretty quickly?
When the rest of the sheet pushes down because your leg's hitting it?
Saran wrap over the toilet?
Can I just kick it? Wait, what was that?
Saran wrap over the toilet.
No, talk to me about this.
Well, you used Saran wrap. I even get it quickly. Pick that one up quick.
Right to the scatological humor.
Okay.
So you just underneath the seat over the bowl.
Oh, I see.
Clear Saran wrap, you pee.
Doesn't that really penalize the guy that has bathrooms the next day as opposed to the peer?
The peer gets a little on his leg, probably.
But I'm still thinking the real onus is on the guy that has bathrooms the next day.
That's the one who's getting fucked.
And that might be you.
It could be.
Hey, fool.
Depends. Did you do the wheel? We used to have like a spinning wheel about who would do the chores.
No, I don't think we did that.
How'd you sort that shit out?
That was part of the
spinning
wheel.
No, there was a rotating schedule, I think.
Ours started with a spinning wheel.
And I remember Stan Feld taught me how to make my bed so you could bounce a quarter off of it.
Yeah.
Stan Feld was what at that point?
He was my group leader.
Wow.
And he was the first group leader that I had.
What was he like? Was he lighthearted at all? Because it was so serious.
No, he was lighthearted. Stan, I used to laugh with Stan.
Stan, bless him, really was an electric personality. And again, I'm going to date myself here because he had a penchant for cigars.
That I remember.
I will say, other than Moss, the guy that got me the most, the adult that got me the most at Swagger was Stan Feld.
Really?
Yep.
No, Stan was
connect with Stan.
Great personality, and really, I don't remember him as being, you know, a disciplinarian at all.
No, I didn't mean that. I guess he just seemed like such an adult to me. I didn't have the humorous moments with him. Maybe he was a funny guy. I knew he wasn't like a stiff or whatever, but I guess I just didn't have a warm interaction with him.
Right? He was busy, and especially in our day, because I think Dave really delegated a lot more to Stan. I would assume. When we were
right,
campers,
Dave was getting older.
You know, so he was more in charge of the managerial aspects of the day to day things that occurred at camp.
Different relationship because you don't have the time to know the personalities of absolutely everybody.
But I remember
were the Leibowitzes involved? Sheila running the office. Back
no,
at
those
that point?
Names don't.
Doesn't ring a bell.
Don't ring a bell. The only gripe I had about Stan was that he had a system. He lived in one of the J bunks at the back.
Okay.
And every now and again, he would dispense soda to the kids, and there would be like a throng that he had opened his door and he took out. And we got these paper cups. You know the ones that you get in the hospital with the pills in it? They were like a microgram cup size. And not only were they too small, because I'm a huge consumer of Coca-Cola, but he served Pepsi. And I kept saying to him for like 10 years.
Not RNC? We had RNC.
Or White Rock, what do we
call it? White Rock.
I thought it was White Rock.
See, for me, it was like Coca-Cola.
We had like off-shelf brands.
Yeah, we had the cheapest stuff the guy could get his hands on and still
some
call
like
soda.
Bootleg cola thing going on. I think the Gonzalez's made it themselves.
Soda Stream.
There you go.
So he used to dispense that. And he, I'm sure he'll deny this, but we could influence him somewhat with a cigar.
Where did you get this stash?
Have them come up on visiting day?
Would you have some Cubans that you had?
No Cubans.
I need Richie you, Rich.
They were Monte Cristo. Bearings. He smoked Bearing cigars. And we used to get him on the ride to Galilee.
I thought you like if you had
when
your
we
parents
went with the
bring
horses,
up.
We would go and we would get like...
That's great.
Everybody would chip in. What are we going to get for Stan? Because he's on inspection this month or this week or today, whatever.
These guys were smarter than this. Bribing their group leader.
Imagine buying Stan a smoke.
Hey, Stan. And all these guys ended up on Wolf.
He's a stogie.
So they got an early start. You know?
They had knowing how to negotiate.
Exactly. You know, we want to get Stan on here, you know, to tell his tales. But you know what? When we do, I think we bring some good cigars with us.
I think so.
Yeah, right? We indulge with him, I think,
he's still
too.
Allowed to smoke, but he actually, I'll email you a short story, which is 90% nonfiction about Stan.
That's good.
You know,
it's
about 10%.
It's close enough for us.
10% where he conquers the Nazis.
Yeah. Some liberties taken. And I'll email you the story because it really is, in many ways, a reflection of, you know, all of the things that you feel when you first go to camp and you're insecure and you don't know your way around, you don't know your ropes, and things like that. But he had a deft touch with relating to the children, so that, you know, there were these inevitable emotional crises of one form.
He was very good that way. I mean, I just thought he was the face for us of the management of Swago. Dave, to me, was not quite as distant as Audrey, but I didn't really have much to do with the mother. We talked about it. There were two times where I got in trouble and he yelled at me and scolded. But that was really it. And you know, I didn't even get the tour. I didn't meet Dave pre-Swago. So Stan, to me, was the guy that did the day-to-day, and I enjoyed my interaction with him. I just remember, I have a specific memory of being like at Milk and Cookies. Did they have Milk and Cookies when you were there? All right.
Yes.
You know, sort of at the end of rest hour, and just laughing with Stan, just sort of feeling like he's laughing at my stuff like a regular guy would, and feeling like pride in the fact that I've got this adult laughing at what I'm saying. So that's my little Stan story.
He had really, at the point which I first met him, he was, as I say, a group leader, and he had a very personal touch. Really, and you felt comfortable that you could go to him and talk to him about something, or that if you didn't talk to him, he would know about it and he would come and pull you.
He'd find out anyway.
And let you.
He'd give little inspirational speeches, like when we would leave for like one of the under-16 tournaments. He'd come on the van. Remember, he would give, like, guys, I just want you to know, you know, you're representing somebody. He'd like, give it this, like, and he looked a little bit like Vince Lombardi, too, like in our day. So it was like this very sort of inspirational Vince Lombardi-like speech he'd give. And he'd always end it with a little jokey thing. But it was all good. He just made us, you know, aware of the fact that you're leaving camp, you know, behave, don't get into too much trouble, have fun. And,
well, you know, he has a huge history with Swago. I think he started there actually in the 40s.
Wow.
As a counselor?
Probably as a counselor.
Yeah, I don't think. I guess we would have known if he was a camper, but I guess it didn't extend
but
that far.
But definitely as a counselor at some point in time.
Yeah.
He was there for a long time, and he and his wife, are really also fonts of information that you can use to make the jigsaw puzzle come together.
Yeah.
For Swago and Swatona.
This New York Ethical Society thing is a big piece. Like, I'm really curious about that.
I'm thinking
that
it is, and I think that we don't really. Well, I say we. I certainly don't appreciate the impact that it may have had. I think that there was something behind it, behind the formation of the camp, apart from simply being a business or you know, a simple way to get kids.
It was a vision that was somehow synonymous with that.
There was a vision, and I think that you can see it in another way, perhaps, in that the environment of Swago gave you an ethic without relying on religion, even though they
here it is. Ethical culture is premised on the idea that honoring and living in accordance with ethical principles is central to what it takes to live meaningful and fulfilling lives.
There you go.
Agreed.
It's the ethical movement. Sorry, just reading here on Wikipedia.
I think what's the other high school in Riverdale? Not the one.
Ethical Culture.
Ethical Culture. It is.
Well, I think they're Ethical Culture is.
Fieldston, I think, is associated with these guys.
It's the school of in Manhattan is up through ninth grade, and that's the School of Ethical Culture.
Okay.
And then it's Fieldston when you get up to.
Okay, because I remember when Kendall was thinking about going to one of this was somehow coming up then. That's interesting. I'm going to take a look at it. But it's so on the money, though, because it did teach you ethics in this very roundabout, non-direct way, you know,
without resorting to dogma.
Right. Well, what was the religiosity of Swago when you were there? Because for us, it was basically 100%. Friday nights before dinner, we would stand for a prayer that lasted no more than maybe two minutes.
I can't remember any prayers at all.
Right.
That Dave Kaplan's wife didn't light the candles or anything. That was what Dave Blumstein's wife did. She would light the candle,
say a prayer, and that we'd stand for it.
I don't remember anything like that at all. Not even an acknowledgement of the Sabbath when I was there. I think that's probably in keeping with the idea of the ethical culture society. In other words, the respect, the understanding, cooperation is there, but without associating it
with any particular
religion.
I mean, it still felt like at Swago. It wasn't overt, but it still felt like it was a Jewish camp. I mean, I think the Friday night services was sufficient enough to qualify it as that.
I think that probably represents a change from when I was
there. From when you were there, all right.
From when I was there. I don't recall any service.
That was Rita's influence.
You know, I'd be curious to know what did Swatona do the same exact thing, or did they do more or less?
I don't know. You were in that back room there with the girls. Well, if they weren't doing it at the boys' camp, they might not have been doing it at the girls'.
I don't recollect anything of that nature in Swatona either. And I think I have to be careful before I put my foot in my mouth with another political statement, but I think that there's been a return to the rituals I think that when Swago, for example, was formed, it was deliberate not to invoke these rituals, the religious rituals, because the influence, obviously, of the Jewish culture is straight through. You've got.
I think, though, I remember seeing some photos that maybe you had posted that were from the 20s or the 30s, and they were reenacting biblical scenes.
Yes, those.
Which
things,
I thought it was almost more so.
That's right.
Okay,
there is that. They did do that, and you're absolutely right. I hadn't remembered that, but you are absolutely
right. That's not a Jewish thing.
Maybe it's not. Maybe they're doing it from a historical perspective.
I think maybe a little bit of both, but by doing the stories, they did it like as a one-off. You know, they have a play.
People getting dressed as Jesus.
There's one where they're really like all out. The guy's like in a frock.
That's
with a staff.
Got the staff.
Yeah,
nailed his wrists right into the cross. It was crazy.
That was the end of the Apache.
Burn. You had to burn him on the cross.
Nail, baby, nail. I'm sorry. That's
okay. It was a Jewish camp. Anyone listening here couldn't care less.
But I think there was an effort in the beginning not to. And I think that over time people have come back to it. I'm not personally observant at all.
Right.
We're not really either.
And there is less, I shouldn't say less as the time goes by, because as I started to say, which is exactly the opposite, a lot of people return to it. That's not my approach.
You're going further? Drifting further away?
Yeah, not from the culture. You know, the culture to me is fascinating and rich and deep and long, and you can look at it and draw some amazing conventional wisdom from 5,000 years of history.
Absolutely.
But as a religion, mm-hmm. Particularly Orthodox, also I, with apologies before I put myself into the middle of the argument, I lived and worked in the Middle East, and three of the closest friends I ever made in this lifetime are Egyptian.
Mm-hmm. Get the hell out of here.
Thank you for joining us tonight.
Okay, the ski slip's over.
Lighting's good. Did you finish the line?
You touch that glass again, Andrew.
Trouble. So my vision, and this is not to plaster over the anti-Semitism. I mean,
Moose is seething right now.
Yeah, right now I know. So apologies.
It's okay.
Right?
So, all good.
So my view is tempered by the fact that the problems that are there are not abstract to me. The last time I was in Egypt was 2008. And I went there and I met two of my friends. One of them is gone now. Two of them are gone. And we went down to the Red Sea, mm-hmm. and just sat around. Now, we were forever arguing politics. Don't understand me. They had a different perspective, obviously, than I did. And at the end of it, we'd end up laughing at the nonsense and the ridiculousness of outrageous positions. And finally, we looked at each other and we would say, if the four of us can sit at a table and laugh, right, what's the problem?
Right.
Right? There's three Muslims there and one Jewish guy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're kidding me. Thank you.
My pleasure. We don't fool around here.
And I'll go one step further if I can digress to a very short, but I think
anything
it's a
you want.
Significant story. So I was in Cairo after a job. I was out there making a presentation, and I was staying there for a long time. And those were the days before credit cards. There were no credit cards in those days to be used at the hotel. The only way you paid was in cash. And I was a good customer, and I ran up a bill in, I'm talking about 1975, 76. I ran up a bill for $3,000. So I booked the call.
What were you doing?
Just nothing. Just all right. Just sunny. I had the greatest suntan of my life. It lasted for 2 years after I left the country.
How long was the stay that it ran up that amount?
Well, actually, I worked there for 4 years.
Okay. Oh, you worked there. Okay.
Yeah, I worked and lived there for four
okay.
years.
Okay. Not at the hotel, but in Egypt, and you were staying at the hotel. Gotcha.
But I was in the hotel in the height of summer for about 3-4 months.
Okay.
So I had a book a call. Those were the days before direct dialing.
Mm-hmm.
Wait in the room for 3 hours, and the operator calls me back. And I called my partner in New York. And I said, yo, I'm out here in Cairo, and I need $5,000. Would you wire me $5,000? And I don't know, are we allowed to use abusive language here?
Yeah.
And the guy.
No FCC regulations.
He says, do you have any fucking idea what's going on here in New York? We were working for Herman's World of Sporting Goods at the time. We had like six jobs running.
Ed Koch is telling the city to drop dead. Right. Well, not Ed Koch. I'm sorry. President Ford.
And and he said, I got a payroll to meet in 2 days for 35 guys. He said, fuck you. And he hung up.
Oh.
I had...
Nice partner.
That was my partner. Well, he was right, actually. If I had been in issues, I would have sent somebody out, you know, two torpedoes from Staten Island. Mm-hmm. So I had 35 Egyptian pounds in my pocket, which was about $60. And that was it. And $3,000 at the desk I owed. And I was dickering for this feasibility study, a small project with this guy in a bank. So I got a taxi and I drove over to the bank, walked in the bank. And I came in, I said,
hey,
I said, yo, right now you go straight Brooklyn. I said today, and literally I said this to him, I said, today we're going to do it like we do it in Brooklyn. Enough cocking around. Here's my pen.
Cocking around, that translated well.
Right. He was like overwhelmed. And he looked at me and he looked at the pen and the paper and he said, okay. And he signed it. So I said, paragraph 3, advance payment, $10,000.
And we're going to change the account where it goes to now.
No, he says to me, okay, no problem, because we're in a bank. He says, paragraph 4, bank guarantee. You know what a bank guarantee is?
Yeah.
A demand instrument, mm-hmm. right? Says, bank guarantee. I said, have the check waiting for me. I'll be back here tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
Went back to the hotel, and I called one of my friends, and I told him, look, this is what happened. I got this job. My partner hung up on me. I'm broke.
For me funds.
I'm broke. You know what his
stuck
reaction
in Cairo.
Was? Amazing. He came to the hotel. He didn't answer me.
This is a guy in Egypt.
This is my Egyptian friend.
Oh, Egyptian,
one
okay.
of the,
okay.
One of my
Muslim
three,
cat.
Three brothers. They okay. really, they were brothers. They were closer to me than my own blood
okay.
brother. He didn't answer me. He looked at his watch and he said, come on, Andrew, we still have time to make the bank. We got an attack in his car. We drove to his bank
mm-hmm.
and he went into the manager's office and he said, I want you to open a bank guarantee in favor of Andrew with, it was the client, and get it prepared now. And he just handed me $10,000.
Right.
In 1975. So you're talking about
that level of trust and good faith
right.
and honesty and integrity.
And I delivered this study and he, you know, the bank guarantee was never called.
That's great.
But this, you know, so my perspective, as it were.
Yeah, you can't go with the labels. So people are people. You're a good person or you're not a good person.
You know, and there are lousy people there too.
I'm sure. It doesn't break down by you know, religious group or geographic area. It's what your soul is, you know?
And there are good people. And so it's difficult for me not to understand that people have different points of view. They obviously do, and they have valid points of view. But I'm probably most resistant where people speak in absolutes. That's really, if you want to push
right my black buttons, and whites yeah right
if you want to push my buttons, that's, I'm telling you up front, that will do it. You can tell me that the moon is green cheese, but if you'll stand up and say to me, well, this is my reasoning, this is why I feel that way,
right.
but at the end of the day I don't accept your logic or I accept your logic, that's a different story to me.
I'm with you. Nothing's qualitative. Nothing's either exactly, you know, 100% one way, 0% the other way.
No, because
I will say, though, it's just sort of like a, not even from a religious perspective as a Jew, but just as a Jew generally, like the world's ability to sort of point the finger at Jews or claim that they're doing wrong in situations where it seems it wouldn't be the case for other people is, to me, mind-boggling. Like, even like the UN as an example, like when they'll come down with on Israel for human rights, it just seems to me like, how is that possible when there are so many other countries? Unless I'm being, you know, spoon-fed bullshit about what these other countries are doing.
I think perhaps the question is, how do we view that? In other words, the UN comes down on various peoples from time to time.
Yeah, but Israel's been reprimanded more than any other country on the earth by the UN. And it just seems, are they the worst, most horrible country? And even if you said, listen, they're overly aggressive in the way...
Is that true? They've been reprimanded the most?
Well, yeah, yes.
It's crazy.
I don't know the numbers, but I would be... I have no reason to doubt you that it's the case. And yes, it is the case. But also, the history now of the creation of Israel and the background and everything else is also losing itself into the mist of time.
You know, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you go back, for example, to the pre-creation days, pre-1948.
Balfour Declaration.
You've got the Balfour. But let's just talk about comments like that came out of Albert Einstein, because he was intimately involved with the people who created the state, and they wanted him at some point to assume the presidency of the state. And he objected to the two-state solution. He wanted a one-state solution, right? Which if you say one-state solution now, right, know where the doors are.
Right.
You know where the fire exit is, because you're gonna be jumped on for that.
Right. I'm leaving Netanyahu in the last election with the misspeak.
And I put this out.
Misspeak. They're all the same, the politicians. It's the end of the day. Come on.
No, I meant during my term.
I didn't mean that.
During my term, there won't be a two-state solution.
How long is your term? Could be forever.
Exactly. So we tend to forget that that there is a history there prior to the creation of the state. And there was a lot of arguments and a lot of different points of view about it. And also, not to put too fine a point on it, that the creation of Israel, besides the proactive things that were done by the Zionists at that point in time, you also had this feeling in Europe, which reminded me of the feeling that existed in America after Lincoln freed the slaves. Okay, you're free now. Now we're going to find a place for you back in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And this is not your country. Right? So there was and this threat. Well, for Europeans following the Second World War, that this was, in my opinion, part of the thinking that gave the support to the creation
absolutely
of the state. They, you know,
but for Hitler, there is no Israel.
In a sense, yes. If not for the Holocaust, there's no Israel. And also because they're hoping, against all hope, that every Jew in Europe will pick up and go.
Okay.
Right? Because the right truth is that, and you have to
remember, side benefit. Well, this is a good way to get rid of
you
them.
Have to remember that Jews were pushed into the sea in England before the Spanish did it in 1492. You go back to 1100 and something.
Listen, it's historic. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it is, but it is.
Well, if you go around killing people's God, you can ask yourself what it's going
to
be like.
You think it comes down to that? You think that's what it's about? Because it doesn't seem like, you know, the Italians aren't getting beat up by being Romans, ancient, you know, and they you know, you would say like they have more responsibility for killing the God.
Because they have the Vatican.
Yeah,
they came back and did their atonement. And
I don't think it's that. I think it's something beyond our knowledge in terms of energy dynamics, in terms of what it is about, why Jews get persecuted historically. But all I know is that it does exist. It keeps happening, and to think that we're somehow beyond history because it's, you know, 2015 is naive.
Well, it's the easiest way to just put that in perspective is like, oh, it was just the 1940s that happened? How fucking long ago was that?
That's nothing. It's blink of an eye.
That's nothing.
Humankind has not physiologically evolved.
And to say something like that couldn't happen, it's like it happened so recently. How could you say it couldn't happen? And it's happening every day.
Which is why I think like Israel, like even if you want to beat up Israel and say they don't do everything right, it's like, you know, based on history, it's like they have an absolute basis to exist. I mean, there has to be this last refuge for Jews to go to because of how human history has played out.
From a practical standpoint, I accept what you say, that there is, and even in my mentality, which I have to say is probably as removed from the idea of a Jewish state as can be, I still have that feeling. You know, like, at the end of the day, what, when all else fails, what do I do? Do I support them or I don't support them? If their back is against the wall, do I vote with them? Do I fight with them? And I feel that too as a Jew. But the other end of the discussion, we'll call it, right, and at the risk of alienating a lot of people, is
I don't think we are.
Europe and the United Nations did to the Palestinian people what the Jews, what was done to the Jews.
Nobody's been put in ovens.
True. That's a very important
That's not important. That's a pretty big distinction.
Well, it's a big distinction if in one sense, but if you're living and you're the 400 generations before you have lived on a piece of land located in the Middle East which had no connection to the events of the Holocaust, and someone comes and now says,
you know what,
your neighbors are now co-owners, I think there are some issues.
If the situation was reversed and all the Arab countries were Jewish nations and Israel was an Arab nation. Right. And all of a sudden there were these people that were being, you know, kicked off the land, and they were Jews, and there's you know, 12 other Jewish nations. I mean, how easy would it be, how instantaneous would it be for those countries to say, you know what, come live here, assimilate, be here, be one of us, we'll take you in.
I don't know if you were the one being kicked off, that would be your immediate reaction?
No, I'm taking to the worst case scenario that, okay, literally it is them being kicked off, but if the situation was completely reversed and it was one Arab country that all of a sudden needed this land because the Arabs had been slaughtered in World War II and there were 12 surrounding Jewish nations, and the Jews were being kicked out and taken. It would take 2 weeks to raise sufficient funds and to get the charity stuff going to bring those Jews into those other countries and assimilate them into the culture and take care of them.
I'm going
to
give you a different take, a different...
And I'm not saying that's right. I'm just saying that would be the effect of that happening.
Okay. I'm going to give you a different take on, not to reject your opinion. I don't at all. But the irony is...
What would Audrey say about this?
What would Audrey say? She'd kick me
back. W-W-A-S.
The TP.
W-W-A-S.
The irony is, and I don't think that American Jews realize this yet, that there is this process that has gone on from the time of the creation of Israel to now, which is transformative for Israelis. And it's not yet recognized because we're still thinking of Israel as we thought of it when it was created, which is a European nation planted in the Middle East.
Sure, right.
And all those guys, the Zionists and everything, they're fundamentally, they're all...
European, yeah, right. They absorbed European culture for at least 500 years.
Right, and they are not today a European nation. They are a Middle Eastern nation. And the evidence of this is actually...
I was just in Israel a couple of weeks ago, and I found it to be very European in a way.
You think so. But I'll give you one example, and you're free, of course, to comment on that. The man got up prior to the election, and he said...
Netanyahu, you're talking about.
Yeah,
okay.
Right? Bibi. And he said, no two-state solution on my watch.
Right. You're right. And he, right. And then he
and then he got he walked gets back, elected. Right.
And he said,
then,
oh, during my term, while I'm still prime minister. Term, right.
And then he does a 180. And when people said, well, how can you do that? His answer was almost like Groucho Marx. So what you don't see here, which I feel from my experience in the Middle East, is the gap between a European mentality and a Middle Eastern mentality. In the Middle East, you can say anything. Because it doesn't matter. There are two things that don't matter. Words and the clock. They simply don't count.
Mm-hmm.
We used to say amongst our friends in Cairo that we could never coordinate a bank robbery. We'd rob the bank at 12 o'clock and the getaway car would not get there until 2 o'clock the next day.
All right.
We were lucky. And it's the same with words. We in the
West...
Yeah,
but that's a shame because like your words are what you're expressing. And unless there's integrity behind them, then it means nothing. Yeah.
But if you live in a world where everybody behaves in another way...
It's chaos.
Well, it may be chaos, but it still functions. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't function the way we think it should function.
Mm-hmm.
And this is usually the kind of cultural gap that leads to a war, which in that part of the world there's plenty of. There are so many gaps between cultures. We make hidden assumptions about things that we think
Moose.
Are routine. And this is one of them. The guy can say one thing on Monday, another thing on Tuesday, and he's not bothered.
Mm-hmm.
He's not bothered at all. Now, is he really for it or really against it? I couldn't even say. I'm not tagging him with either one of those statements. I just simply say he comes from a different mentality. He is the enemy. Now, he has become of the same ilk as the people he's fighting in terms of the way that he does business.
I would think, though, that if he was guaranteed a two-state solution where it was live peacefully for, and maybe I'm naive, but if it was live peacefully together, two states, he'd be incredibly relieved and grateful for that to occur. And I don't think the reverse is true. I think there's an existential non-acceptance of Israel on the Arab side that doesn't exist with respect to Israel.
Well,
in the Arabs.
I understand that from a practical point of view, and also from the point of view of if we want to be fair, right? We've tagged him now. What about the other side? Well, the other side is out of control because the factional groups in that part of the world are not under the control of anybody in particular. So on any given day, anybody can launch a mortar attack against Israel. So how do you stop that? And I don't have the answer to that, by the way. So I understand the Israeli point of view of worrying about security, but I table this only because, really, in my view, having been there since the Camp David agreements were signed, I entered the Middle East, entered Cairo about that time. And my sense is that it was one of the greatest missed opportunities of the century.
What was?
the Camp David agreements, and okay. it failed for a fundamental
but those reason. I mean those treaties are still in place, though. There's still a peace treaty between Egypt and Israel,
yes,
so
that's very important. But the animosity, when I visited in 2008, my friends were livid with Israel, whereas mm-hmm. when I first met them, and they had a kind of healthy respect because they had been in the army.
Mm-hmm.
Two of them had been in the military.
What were they so upset about?
I think what they were upset about is that at the end of the day, no one built on that agreement to do something, and it's a problem for Egyptians as well.
Sure,
as
yeah, it's Israel, bilateral, right?
A bilateral agreement. And it led ultimately to the demise of Mubarak, because nobody took those agreements and invested in people. Okay, they said, okay, there's peace now, everybody's happy. You know, Zygesund, or the equivalent in Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
Go and be well, and you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, you've got. Don't forget, the Palestinians are in the twilight zone for all of this time, as a peoples, and no one went for education, no one went for jobs, no one went for trade. No one said, okay, well, what can we do now? What does Egypt need that Israel can make?
It was based on taking whatever money was available and using it to buy bombs and missiles and things that would hurt Israel.
Well, everybody did that as a matter of course. They were all investing in their army, but nobody sat down and said, okay, well, now that's great that we've signed this thing. What are we going to do with all these people? You know, Egypt, I was shocked. In fact,
when you say people, you're talking the citizens of Egypt?
Citizens of the
or Gaza?
Everybody.
Okay.
Everybody on the side of the people that are most directly affected. So you have the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, and then also you have the whole of the Egyptian nation, right, which has this opportunity to step away from military first solutions and look at other things. And one of the things that I said to my friend when I got back to Cairo in 2008, and it's since changed actually, but I said, I don't believe that in 30 years they couldn't find the money to build another museum in Cairo. The Cairo Museum, of course, is the storage and custodian for an immense history.
Sure.
Right? And it looks like your closet looks better. Okay. There's been no money spent on this.
My closet looks pretty good, by the way.
Not
well, maybe I'll give you the job. We'll go over
beautifully
there
organized.
I had Marty Leavitt as my arts and crafts guy. I made some nice hangers and stuff.
So, you know, nobody thought of a way. When I was traveling up and back.
Whose fault is that? What does that mean? Like nobody found a way for the people to do what? To get jobs and stuff? Or to like for government to employ the people of Egypt? Is that the issue?
Well, that's not.
And why is that? How is it Israel's fault?
No, it's not Israel's
okay.
fault at all.
Okay.
I'm saying there's both sides okay. is a lost opportunity because it's symptomatic. In the 70s, you had the Lake Nasser was going to flood the Temple of Ramesses in Upper Egypt.
Whoa, we're getting deep here.
We've talked about this on episode 17. We did the same thing.
Right? So, you know, because of the architecture and everything.
Yeah.
So what they did was very simple. It was an immense project. It was carried out by a German engineering company, and it's a miracle, really.
Mm-hmm.
They saved the thing. And every time you came through the Cairo airport as a visitor, you paid, I think it was like $2 or $3 for the visa, and you got a stamp in your passport which said that you had paid towards the reconstruction of the Temple of Ramesses.
Okay.
Well, so all they needed to do was the same again, thank you.
Take those
much.
Funds, actually right. use them for what they were said they were going to use
right.
them
for. Right, and the objective being not only the preservation and the display of these things, which is, of course, very important, but it's an attraction. It brings more people. If you knew that tomorrow, like you read about the...
Yeah, I remember Egypt 10 years ago being a place that was sort of on the list of places to go.
Yeah.
I'd love to see the pyramids.
I keep saying I'd like to go there right now.
Now it's like, well, I'm not going
it's
there.
It's not even on the list.
Now
not even a consideration set.
of course, the atmosphere there is pretty bad.
What do you think of the president there now? Are you a fan or not a fan? Because I heard him interviewed recently, like in the probably last week sometime, and I was actually impressed by his demeanor, and you never can tell, but with these guys, but I mean, he seems...
No, you really can't, and of course, the army has a position in Egypt which is more or less hidden in the press. You don't realize that they are not just a military organization.
Well, they overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood to get the political office that they hold now.
Yes, and I have to say, I wasn't very unhappy with that.
No, I'm not either.
Right? We understand that. I would rather, and this is like...
I'll take secular over Islamic fundamentalist any day.
Right. And because they're actually a business, the army in Egypt is a huge enterprise. They have their own factories, they make their own clothing, they have, you know, all sorts of things, bakeries mm-hmm. and oil interests and whatever. So I don't think that they did it out of any political ideology. I think the army took it back because they said, oh, my God. You know what? If you go back to almost any issue, if we remove ourselves from the Middle East, what's the expression? Follow the money.
Follow the money.
Follow the money.
People are in it for their selfish reasons and right. whatever yeah. material and gain they can have.
Exactly.
Which I never quite understand. Like really? Like, at the end of the day, like, what does that do for you? I know it's good. Yeah, I know money's good, and you get, but at the end of the day, like, your experience is your experience, and like, if you get money by ill-gotten means, like, doesn't that ruin it? Like, isn't your head a little heavy? Like, when you put your head down on the pillow, go to sleep at night.
For a lot of people.
I applaud you because if the world ran like that,
but I think
it would be a better place.
But I think it does. I think at the end of the day, it does run like that. I think people lie to themselves that it doesn't bother them when it must.
Well, maybe they do lie to themselves, yet they still go out and do it.
Agreed. But at the end of the day, I think it's still a pit in your stomach. It's still something you live with.
Anybody on Wall Street return the money for selling a credit default swaps?
No, but I think a lot of these guys. I think there's an implicit in that there were these guys who sort of were aware of the fact that what they were doing was never going to work out. I think a lot of these guys, hook, line, and sinker, were thinking, hey, man, this mortgage thing is great. It's a never ending. Benefit that's going to keep accruing to us. I don't think there were these guys who were like, it's going to crash in a Ponzi scheme and I'm making the most of it. I think there were guys that were that way.
They were all well aware of the fact that they were writing mortgages that shouldn't have been written, every single one of them.
I don't think so. I think people get caught up in the momentum of it.
That's the funny part. That's the backstory, the backlash that you hear from people who want to blame the policies, let's say going back even to Clinton, of increasing the mortgage base. But that's not really what brought the economy down.
Yes, it was.
I built those trading floors for a number of years, and I was astonished at what they were doing. I was astonished because it's criminal, and nobody got called to book for it. Nobody.
No.
They issued, and actually the computer systems were in part to blame too. I mean, I don't know how heavily you want to go into this, but you had the credit default swaps being issued without limit. It was insurance that wasn't insurance.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
If you start an insurance company tomorrow, they say, okay, you can issue $100 worth of coverage if you've got $200 or $150 worth of assets.
Right. And what's the ratio of the assets versus what you need to protect
now
against?
They found
300-1. Okay.
There was no
Didn't
control.
Even exist. Yeah.
Didn't exist. So now you have $5 trillion worth of dead paper.
Right.
Being sold by people who didn't understand what it was that they were buying. Now on top
of it. I think the people that sold it didn't understand what they were selling either. I mean,
I agree with you. Okay. They were just turning their heads
I don't think it's this guy with the waxed mustache saying,
I don't think that either.
There are those people. I think it was my friends
who worked for a mortgage company.
They didn't know
what they were doing. This is what they're telling me to do. They're approving the mortgages.
Exactly. It's a great thing. Government backs it.
But it was based on a model which got so complicated that even the people who engineered it didn't bother to tweak it. There was supposed to be, when they created the asset-backed mortgage packages, right, for resale.
Right, and the rating system for that was just ridiculous.
Forget the rating system. What was supposed to happen is that when they assembled the subprime mortgages into a package, they were supposed to be labeled subprime.
Right.
Okay. Now comes the genius of Wall Street and says, look, you don't have to worry about it being subprime because I'm going to staple that to a piece of paper.
That's exactly right. I'm going to mix this with the A-rated mortgages. Right. And now it's not subprime anymore. Now it fits into the A class.
You don't have to worry. What's the difference? Subprime, triple A.
You go bad, whatever. It's
all covered. So these guys did it. And then, of course, you had the core at Goldman Sachs that knew exactly what they were doing. And they were advising their key clients to sell short. At the same time that the other side of the same floor.
What was the book I read? It was the Michael Lewis book.
The speed trading book?
No, it was the one on the mortgage. Was it not Liar's Poker, but it's probably one of the other ones.
Too Big to Fail?
No. Whatever. I'll post it if we need to. But it's a great book on this whole issue of the mortgage-backed securities and the derivatives that came from them and how You know, there were maybe two guys that were like, this is insane. You know, this right. is not going to work right. out. And those guys are obviously heroes and made a lot of money shorting the stuff. But the rest of the world, including these, you know, Lehman Brothers, were hook, line, and sinker saying, no, this is a gravy train that's never going to end.
They didn't know.
People are not that smart. You think people know what they're doing, but they don't.
No, I accept that already.
Right? You turn a certain age, you realize, wow, there's no experts.
Well, gentlemen, I'd love to talk about the fall of 2008 for the rest of the night, but you're getting close to your time.
Let's get back to Gobstoppers. Yeah. Okay. Let me see. Oh, my God, I am. I'm over my time. Sorry about that. All right, I got a 50th birthday party to go to.
Well, Andrew,
this has been... I hope everyone enjoyed the sort of like little derivative thing.
Very nice. I'm glad we've been wanting you to come on. I think you were a way for us to bridge the gap to a couple of generations before.
It's just the beauty of like not knowing you personally before
it's
this.
Really and then, nice
like,
for you to come join us.
Are we going to get dinner out of this?
We are, absolutely. We got to finish this conversation, so we're going to.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll let you out the door.
All right. Well, thank you for coming on.
It's been a real pleasure, guys.
It's great to meet you. Thanks so much.
Really.
Really glad you could join us.
All right, everybody.
All right. Peace out, everyone. Swago.
You know.
Bye for now.